This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on July 13th, 2017. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
This will convene the open session of the Federal Election Commission for today. I apologize for the delay, but sometimes these occur when there's new documents being prepared to look at, and it takes time to digest them and figure out what steps you want to take in connection with the drafts that are forthcoming, and that's what happened here. We're taking up the first matter with respect to the request by the House of Representatives to permit public use, campaign funds for use in connection with improvements to residences for purposes of safety. And we have a number of documents that are been made blue, which we call ones that have been on file, that you can see that address that issue. First of all, I'd like to just thank Sergeant-at-Arms Paul Irving, who's with us today, and his assistant, Tom Blodgett, Deputy Sergeant-at-Arms, for working with us in the process and for your ingenuity in deciding to take a run at this approach for the Federal Election Commission to consider. And I know that the people that you worked with have thought you've been really great to work with. And I wanted to also mention that I did have a conversation last night with by telephone, basically just saying the same thing, that it's been nice to have him here to work with. The the exception that we're talking about today has three minor differences, and we have I know that there's votes to no matter what will happen, I want you to know at the outset of our conversation that ultimately the commission wants to move forward with granting that request, and we have some ways that we see things differently, but I think ultimately we'll have no difficulty in the long run in providing that relief. The three documents changed a little bit, and I'd like to address some of the changes that are before you. There are the path I took with what's called Draft B. Draft A, which you're quite aware of, grants the request pretty much as requested, and that has the support of a significant number of commissioners here. I made a proposal on my own that's different, but ultimately I believe that when the push comes to shove, that AO draft should be ultimately prevail if it has to. The difference between the proposal that I made and the one that has the draft A and mine is draft B, a difference in a couple of respects. We have experience with providing exceptions to the personal use in the past in three instances with respect to members of the House. And in those particular cases, each particular member came to the House, specified the nature of the threat, and usually it was in the after a significant matter occurred, and made a specific proposal with respect to the type of improvement wanted. In each instance, the commission has granted that. And I think it's safe to say that if people want to continue that process, no matter what happens today, and I'm not saying that it would change things, we have in place the beginning of a tradition to permit that use of campaign funds for that purpose. In each of the instances, at least there's not been more than I think the top amount of money that was expended was $7,000. And in the one in draft A where I have my own concern was that as drafted, there's no limit on other than what's called reasonable on the amount of money that can be spent. And as you know, the way the draft aid provides for, any member of the House can automatically use that money, does not have to come to the commission. For those reasons, I thought that we should cabin in that to have an amount that, if I were counsel, I would want to have some guidance on what I could tell my client. So I suggested, in draft B, $15,000, for example. And I also suggested that we have a term within which we take another look in a year and see what, if anything, can be done at that particular time. We would have a chance to look at the actual nature of the threat with more precision. We would know to a greater degree the extent to which the Senate would have comment, and we could see how well it was working for all of us. That's not in draft A, and I think that those are the two main, the three main differences, as I see it, between those two. Commissioner Weintraub proposes some changes from last night. They've been considered by three of the commissioners, and I think there'll be some discussion back and forth on that. But overall, I think that's pretty much where we stand, rather than try and run everybody through the separate documents. But I would like to thank the Sergeant-at-Arms, Mr. Irving, and invite you to make any comment you might at this time. And by the way, if in the process of going back and forth, you have something you want to add, you certainly feel free to do that. But welcome, and have a seat, and Mr. Blodgett, do the same.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. I do have a brief statement. I thank you for the opportunity to appear before you this morning. Thank you for considering the critical issue of allowing members of Congress to use campaign funds for non-structural residence security systems and monitoring of those systems. Technology has transformed the threat environment that confronts elected officials. The proliferation of internet and social media platforms such as Twitter and Facebook, along with the dark web, has created avenues for individuals to make threatening statements directed at members and their family members, and disseminate information such as addresses, PII, with a cloak of anonymity. Members also face in-person threats. They have been followed and harassed from town hall meetings and have had items left at their residences and residence broken into. United States Capitol Police thoroughly investigate each threatening incident. However, threat investigations are, by their nature, reactive. Valuable time may pass before the individual making the threat can be identified. Capitol Police cannot initiate an investigation until a threat has been made. A threat assessment is a term referring to a background threat or direction of interest investigation into a particular member. Threat assessments are resource and time intensive. They require a fair amount of lead time, and unfortunately, violence or harassment of members and their families does not always wait for a thorough investigation. Many individuals act on impulse, and many of them have never made a threat before the assessment is conducted. This was the unfortunate situation on June 14th. The mitigation of these unknown threats is difficult. However, one method is to install residential security systems. Installation of these systems offer protection to a member and their family, and I believe that every member should have a residential security system due to the threat environment that they face solely because of their elected status. Again, I would like to thank the Commission for considering this advisory opinion. Thank you
very much. If the Senior Commissioner would like to ask a question or anything along that line. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for appearing here this morning. You talked about that you think every member should have a residential security system. What are the elements that you typically would advise be part of that system?
Residential security systems are fairly straightforward. Usually it would include a motion sensor. So if someone was to enter the home, Family would be aware of that. There are typically glass breaks or door contacts that would indicate whether a glass is broken or whether a door has been opened. And those, if a signal is triggered, then it would signal would go back to an alarm company that would notify the police to react. Many systems also include panic or duress buttons, so that if someone is home and realizes they're being broken into, they can push a button and immediately get contact with the alarm company and the police. So they're fairly straightforward systems.
Okay. Do you advise upgrading locks and other things like that as part of an enhancement of the security environment around a member's home?
Yes. Usually when a residential security survey is conducted, the company will recommend certain locks be upgraded, for example, incident to that. But I would consider the main portions of the security system to be those that monitor the home versus any structural change.
Okay. Thanks.
Commissioner, do you include cameras? Are security cameras typically incident or what you would recommend a member to have?
It depends. It would depend on the particular instance. Sometimes security cameras are recommended, other times not. I am not going to say a security camera is always a need.
Going forward, how, in your mind, will there be coordination? Or these are dangerous words right now, but any kind of, period during which you work with them on what they want. So do you know that, or do they just go ahead and at this point, I mean, based upon assuming draft A goes through, there would be no reason to require any permission from your office or certainly from the FEC either? So how would that work? In other words,
Members know that they can contact my office and routinely do for any security consideration, whether it's any security advice, whether it's for the district office, whether it's for their residence. So they know that my team can provide them, you know, valuable guidance. And actually, we can, if they do receive a security survey from an alarm company, we can validate that. So they do use us as a resource. There is nothing that mandates that. But it is a rather common practice.
Right. Any further questions? Mr. Goodman.
Is part of the security recommendations you typically make, there are a number of hardware pieces, cameras, locks, distress devices, sensors that you've mentioned. Do you include in what you're asking for non-structural security devices the services that are attendant to those devices, such as the alert system and the people who respond to your home?
I would include the monitoring as part of that cost, and that would be certainly those that respond, which would be either the alarm company or the local law enforcement entity that is tied into that system.
Thank you.
Anything further from Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for coming. I know that Congress recently appropriated extra funds to upgrade the security at congressional offices. Why are you seeking permission for them to use campaign funds as opposed to, you know, obviously they can appropriate funds that they're the appropriators. Why are government funds not being used for these security improvements if they are designed to protect people in their capacity as members of Congress?
I see this as another resource. I cannot address the issue as to why Congress limited to district office versus residence, but I can say that I'm just looking for another resource for members to use to enhance their security.
Have you suggested to members of Congress that, you know, they could do this? I'm just wondering why this route is being chosen rather than the other, and if there's any information that you can provide on that.
I really cannot. There has been discussion into it, and that's about as far as I can say at this point.
It's this goes to, in some sense, to one of my concerns about the process by which this is being put before us. As you know, under our statute, people are entitled to come to us with questions about how the campaign finance law applies to things that they personally are proposing to do. We have tried to guard pretty strictly the ability of we don't want third parties coming in and asking questions about other people's conduct, and also, you know, for a variety of reasons, you know, and one of them is that you're not a member of Congress, you're not the one who's going to be doing this, you know, I can't ask you questions that I could ask of a member of Congress. And honestly, as important as I understand the request to be, and of course I completely understand, we all understand how horrifying the events must have been, and terrifying, you know, I completely agree with you. We live in an increasingly fraught world where people show up at baseball games and pizza parlors with guns. You know, this is it's a crazy world that we're living in these days. And I think we're all sympathetic to the concerns that are being raised here. From a procedural standpoint, the reason that I'm willing to go forward with this request coming from you as a person who is not actually affected by the outcome of this is in part because of the exigent circumstances and in part because of the letter, the supporting letter that we got from Congressman Harper. I found that to be extremely helpful to me. He obviously is a member of Congress and would be affected by the AO, and I'm kind of importing his support into your request to give that standing, basically, to make the request. But it does put us at a bit of a disadvantage because you are not the person who's directly affected by it. It's harder for us to get answers to some of the questions that we might ask. In general, I think I've, on the three prior AOs, I supported, I think I was here for all three of them. I supported those AOs when members were under a specific threat. I do have some concerns, and they prompted some of the edits that I made about the limiting principles. You know, how far could this rationale be used? You know, could somebody, for example, say, I feel unsafe in my current home, so I need to move to a gated community and I need to use campaign funds to pay the higher rent and mortgage or mortgage at a gated community where there'll be extra security. I feel the need to have a high fence around my property or install bulletproof glass. I feel like my family is not secure, so I think I need to send my children to private schools and I want to use campaign funds to pay that, you know, based on my security concerns. I mean, one could imagine the principle of people being concerned about security and their role as a member of Congress and therefore needing campaign funds to buttress their security. One could imagine it, that principle being extended fairly far and to a place that I personally would have qualms about going. I think the fact that we are only talking here about non-structural changes to members' homes gives me puts me in a place where I'm willing to go forward with this on the assumption that it cannot be extended beyond the terms of this, and also the fact that I've suggested that we make sure that it's all explicitly disclosed so that, you know, because we're not putting, I think most of the drafts do not have a dollar limit on this. You know, I've done a little bit of Googling on my own, or my staff has, and, you know, most of these kinds of home security systems are not terribly expensive. You know, we're talking about a few thousand dollars, and that's been the case with the requests we've gotten in the past. And I think as long as we have it all disclosed so that members' constituents can judge if they think they're getting, you know, carried away with how they're using campaign funds, then I think that that resolves that concern. I do think that having the reason that I asked about using government funds is that I think I have a longstanding concern about the indebtedness that can be created between a member of Congress and their donors. And if they are, in fact, relying on their donors for their family's security, I think that sense of indebtedness would only increase. Now, again, I can get past that because it's going to be so diffused over, you know, the number of donors that a member of Congress has. But, you know, I think that as concerned as I know we all are that, you know, members stay safe, I do think there are some countervailing issues on this that we have to bear in mind. As the chairman indicated, I had made some edits to the first draft, which I guess was draft A. The draft that I suggested was draft C, which would again say yes, you know, but just, you know, put a few parameters on the outcome. So that's kind of where I am, and I agree with the chairman. I think everybody is looking for a way to get to yes here.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming this morning. I think we have at least three votes for draft A, which is the one that was put out last week. I'm not sure how my colleagues will vote on that, so I'm not going to make that motion at this time. But my understanding is that some may be willing to join us on draft A, so we'll see how the conversation goes. With respect to the comment of Commissioner Weintraub about this being a third-party request, as you know, we've considered a number of AOs in the past that, in my opinion, were far more of a third-party request than this one, including Senate Majority PAC, including Advisory Opinion 2013-6. And I won't bore you with those details, but this is by no means a third-party request. The Sergeant-at-Arms is the chief law enforcement officer for the institution and therefore is intimately familiar with the day-to-day threats that all members receive due to their status as elected officials. The notion that this would even be considered a third-party request in light of things we've done in the past just doesn't make a lot of sense based on our previous history. With respect to the draft that was placed on the agenda and circulated last night, we've taken a look at it, and there are some points in here that we won't be able to support. I'd be happy to walk through them, and maybe we can get some comment on some of the specific things. And then at the appropriate time, I can make a specific motion removing those things and see if it garners additional support. The crux of the issue that we have, or we want to go back to the language that's been approved in the past that allows for different security systems. So the first edit would be on draft C, page 3, line 20.
This is the blue document, right?
And you've been given a red line, have you not? They have not been given a red line?
I don't
line
think we have that, Mr.
This?
She's operating
draft,
from the blue draft.
The blue document.
Okay, but do you have a red line, Bridget?
I don't think I do, Mr. Chairman, okay. But I'll check here.
Jesus Christ. I don't want to. So, I'm going to make some changes shortly.
The red line's not going to help get on the track.
This is the red one.
Commissioner Weintraub's draft C from the initial draft A.
Everybody's got the red line here.
Got it. Okay, thank you so much.
Did you just give it to him?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay, that's good. The idea behind the red line is to make it a little easier for you to track the conversation, I think, on different points of view.
Yeah.
Okay, so working off the what we call the blue document of draft C.
It's this here. Okay.
The gist of the edits that we would make to this are that we would delete the references to increasing the value of the member's home. Because I think it's fair to argue that anything could be seen as increasing the member of the value of someone's home, anything, even something insignificant. Another sort of overall comment is that we reinsert the language of the request as opposed to a different language that was proposed by Commissioner Weintraub. So at the appropriate places, we would put back in the request, which is residential security systems that do not constitute structural improvements. I'm not going through specifically. I'm just doing a general, and then we can go through specifically line by line. Some of the things that Commissioner Weintraub talked about, I think one of the things you said was moving your kids to a private school. I don't think that's constituting a structural improvement to the home. So I think that that language cabins it in such a way that that we are fine going through, and that's what's been requested. The other sort of global change is the notion that we would use this advisory opinion as a sword, as something to go against people who may have purchased a security system before June 17th is something that we're not willing to support. Obviously, this advisory opinion will be in effect as of the date that it gets four votes here, but to the extent that somebody purchased something in the past, perhaps they were relying on a different advisory opinion, we're not willing to go back in time and say something that you did is now a violation of the personal use provision. So we intend to take that out as well. And that's just a global overview of our changes. And again, happy to walk through them point by point.
Thank you, Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The second one I have no problem with.
Which one was the second one?
You'll have to read the language, but it was the description of it as residential security systems that don't make structural changes.
Oh, right. The one from the Crest, residential security systems that do not constitute structural improvements.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
We're just trying to simplify the language.
Okay.
And and since part of what I was trying to do was provide a framework for people to disclose it, we thought having a shorter term would make it easier in terms of disclosing it. But that's fine. I have no problem with that.
Okay.
What was the last point that you made?
The one about taking out the thing that it's a violation if you.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So let me just explain.
Just so people know what we're talking about, it's on page 5, lines 5 through 7.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Let me just explain what the intent of that was. And I made a point of using June 2017 so that if somebody, I didn't want to actually use the date of this opinion because I thought somebody right after the baseball game was scared for their family, went out and bought, upgraded their security 2 weeks ago, and we put out this opinion today. I think it's perfectly fine for them to take advantage of this opinion. I wouldn't want that person to be in a different situation from the person who was, waited another 2 weeks. That's not the problem. The problem that I was that I wanted to forestall was the possibility that somebody who, for their own reasons, because a lot of people like to have home security systems, might have installed a system 10 years ago just because they, for their own reasons, and now they say, oh, good, now we've got an opinion we can use campaign funds to pay ourselves back for these expenses that we've been incurring for the last 10 years. I don't think that was the intent of the request, but we just wanted that was the issue that I was trying to address there. If somebody had a specific threat that was analogous to one of the other opinions that we've already issued, and in reliance on that opinion, they went out and used campaign funds, I think they would be fine. But as I said, I think, if somebody's had a, let's say somebody's had a home security system since before they were a member of Congress, and they see this opinion and they say, well, now we're going to, reimburse ourselves for all of our home security expenses going back to the day we took the oath of office, I think that would be inappropriate. So that was the issue that I was trying to get at, and as I said, I was trying not to jam people who might have gone out and gotten home security systems a week ago, which I think would have been a reasonable thing for them to do.
Madam Vice Chair.
I hear what you're trying to say. I I can't think of a way of writing that that would not find it illegal for somebody who went back. And I do think people would have, my guess is if they went back and paid for something that was already, yeah, I think we're better off taking the language out, but happy to consider if somebody has an idea to try to capture that. I think, again, people can go back and rely, as you mentioned, on previous advisory opinions.
Could we say, you know, unless they were acting in reliance on a previous advisory opinion issued by the commission?
No, I don't think, because I think we don't ever want to say that, you know, this is a violation of something. Again, I think we're better off taking the language out altogether.
You know, because
Commissioner Weintraub.
Sorry. Unless otherwise allowed by a previous advisory opinion. What if we said, what if we simplified it to this guidance is prospective only as of June 2017?
Madam Vice Chair?
I mean, all of our advice is prospective only.
Right. That's why I'm not really... I mean, you're just trying to capture the people who may have gone out and bought a system between the time that we got the letter and now?
Well, I'm trying to make sure that those people are safe, that it's very clear that they would be protected, because otherwise only people who acted after we formally issued the advisory opinion would be protected under this advice.
But let's go through the other edits and come back to that one. And we might have to take a quick recess in order to write up the edits and present it more formally. But we can consider that.
Did you have another comment,
Commissioner Weintraub? I think that last point is, I've got to believe that's a resolvable issue, because I don't think it's a big debate. I think the intent issue is going to be a little bit more of a sticking point for me. Because we are normally doing things that are related to your home would be personal use. You know, normally we would not allow somebody to upgrade anything in connection with their home as a personal use, and that's why I think we have to be very careful when we are carving out this exemption, that it does not end up swallowing the rule. And this edit was in direct response to a comment that we received from the Campaign Legal Center.
And what was, remind us what that specifically the comment said about the Campaign Legal Center. The Security Campaign Legal Center.
And by the way, I think that, you know, we're talking about non-structural changes. We're, you know, I think what I'm envisioning, and as I understand it, what the request envisions are basically removable objects, you know, the cameras and monitoring that, you know, would not be structural. They're not like fixtures to the home, but if you want to throw in a specific reference to upgraded locks, mm-hmm. I have no problem with that, because I think that, you know, on a multiple $100,000 home, which most homes are worth these days, the added value of improving the locks, I think, is not going to appreciably make a difference in the selling value of the house. So, you know, if that helps us move forward, I'm perfectly happy to say that lock upgrades are included within this. All right. So the comment says, the Act's personal use restrictions are objective and clear. They turn on the nature of the goods and services purchased, such as housing, clothes, non-campaign travel, and other expenses that would exist irrespective of the spender's officeholder duties. Draft A, in contrast, would provide that the key question is not what the spender buys, but rather what he or she intends to accomplish through his or her spending. That subjective inquiry cannot be reconciled with the text of Section 30114. And it goes on to note, and I'm not suggesting that that is what is being requested here. However, this comment states, as we noted in our comment on the request, spending that increases the value of an official's residence has been involved in many corrupt quid pro quo arrangements. And in recognizing members' legitimate and lawful need to secure their homes, the commission should not throw open a door to such corruption. I mean, you know, there have been cases that involved upgrades to members' homes using campaign expenses, or, you know, having people come and mow the lawn, or, you know, all sorts of things like that. And I think that was the concern. I'm not saying that anybody is intending that to happen here. I'm sure they're not. But it was just an attempt to tighten the language to forestall somebody in the future from drawing an erroneous conclusion from the language that we would put out today.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you. So our intention would be to change that to back to the language that we've used in previous advisory opinions, which would be proposed upgrades which were not intended to increase the value of the office holder's property. Because if you install a security system, you're doing it because of the security threat, not to increase the value of your home. And I think it's fair to say that installing a security system, or even installing a motion light in your home, is going to increase the value of your home. So I don't know, I don't think your language is workable, and I think that the intent, again, is from our previous advisory opinions and does capture, in my mind, what you're concerned about. You don't want somebody going using campaign funds to improve their home so they can sell it for more later, but they're doing this in order to protect themselves.
Any further comment?
So are you, sorry.
Go ahead. Do you want to take a few minutes to see if there's any drafting that can...
I'd be happy to take some time, but we have three votes for we're not intended to increase, again, following the precedence of the FEC, and I just need to know if we have a fourth vote for that. I don't think it's a drafting issue.
Commissioner Goodman?
Let me try out a couple of concepts. To the Sergeant Arms, I'm glad you're here to listen, because I'd like your reaction to some of these edits.
Okay.
Okay, to make sure that they serve the security objectives that you're trying to achieve.
Which draft are you working off of?
I'm working on draft C.
Okay.
Because frankly, I share Commissioner Weintraub's concern about slippery slopes here. I thought many of your edits were constructive, and I agreed with some of them. I'm willing to work within the construct of C, but there are some of these. They're more legal concerns for us, but I want to make sure that as we address our legal concerns here, that we get you where you need to go to provide the security your members need.
And do you have a copy of draft C?
I do.
Okay.
And let me just say, as I approach these edits, what I am convinced of is that these security concerns that we're hearing, I'm sure you've had members approach you in the current political environment in which we live and ask you these questions. You didn't come here, I take it, sua sponte. You've had requests from members saying that they feel as though they need security services at their homes.
Yes.
Okay. And so you are representing those concerns here before us.
Yes.
Okay. So what I am convinced of is that a security service on your home has become an incident of holding public office today. And it exists because you serve in public office today. Now, as a consequence of that, adding a security service to your home may enhance the value of your home. Now, we haven't offered home improvements in the past, and so that concept of enhancement of value does get to personal use and personal inurement to the member. Here, since what we are carving out is a very specific exception to the personal use, by recognizing that this is now an incident of public service, I'm just concerned that telling them to tell the Sergeant of Arms and the members of Congress, yes, you can add a security service, including locks appropriate to your residence, but only if it doesn't improve the value of your home. I'm afraid that maybe as a practical matter, an encumbrance that you and your members may have difficulty proving, that they haven't enhanced somehow by adding cameras to their home the value of their home. So as long as we cabin in that this is about security services, that they are non-structural, I'm not as concerned if they happen to incidentally improve somehow the value of the home, because implicit in here is not someone remodeling the kitchen. Okay? So what I'm going to suggest is that on page 3, lines 19 and 20, we strike the proviso and the proposed upgrades did not increase the value of the of office holder's property. So that we don't put people in a catch-22 that, oh, gee, these locks may increase the attractiveness of your home on the market. So long as later we are going to have a litany of the things implied in the security services that we approve. The same phrase shows up on page 4, lines 14 to 15. The proviso, I would strike the proviso that do not increase the value of the members' homes. We would just put a comma after residences and continue regardless. And I don't know if I've captured everything that the Sergeant-at-Arms has covered here, but in the sentence that begins at the bottom of page 4, line 17, specifically, and this is where I'm sympathetic, Commissioner Weintraub, to what you're trying to achieve to prevent slippery slopes, to be as specific as possible. And continuing on to page 5 at the top, I just want to be sure that we cover all of the services attendant to the security upgrades that we're talking about. And so I'm wondering if it would suffice to, on line 1 of page 5, it currently reads cost of cameras, comma, sensors that we splice in, comma, distress devices, and similar non-structural security devices, as opposed to removable. The non-structural was the word used in the request to us, and I believe that's the concept that removable is trying to get at. And after security devices, put as well as locks, comma, in and around a member's residence. And the reason I separate out locks is because I think they are structural. I mean, I think you put a new lock on a door, that becomes a structural change. I think that an advisory opinion stands on all fours. This implicitly does say, in light of the current threat environment, and I don't want to start imputing guilt to things that people may have done in the past and may have a legal argument that it was attendant to their public office that they needed a security system previously. So I don't think we need to go declaring certain things to be unlawful when implicit this implicitly stands for the proposition from this day forward, and there are past advisory opinions, and we would be able to judge those if there were a murmur before us alleging that someone went beyond what we consider to be incident of public office. That those would be edits. Are there other edits that you had to this? I'm trying to collect them all here. Could you just provide? I'm sure. Which page?
Mr. Chairman, if Excuse I may, me. I'll just...
Commissioner Peterson.
Commissioner Goodman pointed out an instance of the concept of increasing the value of a home on lines 14 and 15 of page 4. That is also on lines 5 and 6 of that same page.
5 and 6. And Commissioner Weintraub, I don't have words here. I would be willing to work with you on a footnote, perhaps, because Commissioner Peterson just leaned over and mentioned it to me. I'm not trying to get personal inurement to enhance values of homes. We might be able to fashion a footnote, if we took a brief break, to say that implicit in these is that the intent of the security improvements would not be to improve the value of the home. To preserve that thought running throughout, I'm just afraid that putting it in the text in the way that it is, at every time we say, yes, you can have a security system, but not if it raises the property value of your home, I'm afraid that puts people in a catch-22, and it puts the sergeant at arms in a catch-22 when he has to give advice on what you can do and can't do with your home. But if we add an intent or some type of intent language in the document that the purpose of this is security and not to increase value of home, I think that would cover us from saying and being able to prove objectively that the improvements you made to your home here were really to improve the value of your home, not to provide security, and that was never contemplated by the commission. So I'm willing to try to preserve that concept. I just don't want to do it everywhere we tell the sergeant-at-arms that, yes, people can have it, that that's going to be a caveat.
Commissioner Weintraub?
I think there could be a path forward there if we say non-structural, you know, where we're taking out, you know, so for example on page 4, line 5 to 6, if you want to take out that did not increase the value of the members' homes, then I would want to add in use of campaign funds to pay for the non-structural security upgrades or otherwise.
That's fine, and that is the request before us, right?
Yes.
As otherwise specified in this opinion or, you know, language of that nature. You know, I think the concern that the commenter had, and I do share this, is that, you know, throwing intent in, you know, is really kind of mushes up what is otherwise a hard and fast rule. You know, it's like, well, I didn't intend to have it for my personal use. I mean, how are you ever going to prove whether what somebody's intent was or wasn't? Or maybe I intended it a little bit, but I didn't, you know. I
agree.
You know, it just.
I'm trying to solve the practical problem,
but. And I get that, and I appreciate that. And also, I think that we are in a slightly different posture here than we have been in the past, because in the past we had one member who came to us, and I think in all three instances they said specifically, I want to do this, this, and this, and this is how much it's going to cost. And this is going to be sort of a blanket opinion that, it will be a blanket opinion that everyone is going to point to and say, well, look, I was relying on that.
Mm-hmm. You could possibly do a little to your house, but increase the value a lot, and do a lot, but increase the value nil. But let me ask Mr. Chairman, with a sergeant-at-arms, can you react a little bit to this problem we're dealing with? Both we're trying to get you where you need to go as a practical matter, but also preserve our legal construct?
Thank you, Commissioner. Yes, I do tend to agree with your perspective. Although most of these security systems I don't think would enhance the value of a home appreciably, considering the cost of an average home today, and these security systems are rather straightforward. And frankly, what makes a security system what it is the monitoring, which is a costly fee that the new owner would need to continue. So, however, having said that, I would tend to agree that any language that could constrain, that could cause an implication, such as, let's say, an enhanced lock, that could, in one could argue, could increase the value of the home, could be a constraint. So I do tend to agree that if we could remove that and go forward with the intent of what we're trying to achieve, I think that would be most helpful.
Can you, on the spot, I know I'm putting you on the spot because we haven't been able to do so just sitting here, come up with something other than intent as the cabin for this, because I understand Commissioner Wine, I mean, getting into the intent of people, but right. I understand it's not your intent. You're not worried about remodeling people's kitchens. You're worried about providing security to
security
people. So I understand your intent.
Right.
But for, we're getting ready to let these, we're getting ready to open this barn door a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so how do we cabin that? Is intent the concept, or is there another concept?
I think we can work with you. If you give me a little bit of time to work on it, I think I can come up with something that that narrows this down and hopefully satisfies both sides.
Let's take 15 minutes and see what happens.
Okay.
Okay.
Ready to reconvene. Madam Chair, do you have any motions?
Yes, we have a housekeeping motion that we forgot to do at the outset. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order that the Commission may consider the following documents: agenda document number 17-33A, agenda document number 17-32C, agenda document draft D of the Sergeant at Arms Advisory Opinion Request, agenda document number 17-30B, agenda document number 17-31B.
Okay, thank you very much. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Passed unanimously. Well, I understand we have a deal. Somebody would like to discuss it first.
Would you like me to kind of walk through?
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do have a deal, and that's a good thing. Based on our discussions, both, you know, in the public part of the meeting and in our little confab during the recess, we've agreed to make a number of changes to draft C that I think satisfy everyone.
May I just inquire, does the Sergeant-at-Arms have this current draft?
I do, thank you.
Yeah. So I'm going to be, I think the easiest thing for me to do is to key this to the red line version, which is going to be a little bit confusing for those of you out in the audience who don't have the red line version, but it'll make sense to the Sergeant at Arms and everybody at the table. This is draft D. We've just admitted this document for discussion as draft D, and the changes are as follows. In the paragraph that starts on page 3, line 12, if you go down to the bottom of the page, we have added on line 19 the word specific after recommended, and deleted the phrase at the bottom, the very last phrase on the page, and the proposed upgrades did not increase the value of the office owner's property. So the sentence will read, in all three instances, the Capitol Police recommended specific security upgrades to the members' residences due to the continuing threats, period. In the next paragraph at the top of page 4, what are lines 5 to 6, we're adding the word non-structural before security, and again deleting the phrase that did not increase the value of the members' homes, so that the sentence will read, therefore, the Commission concluded that the use of campaign funds to pay for the non-structural security upgrades recommended by the Capitol Police would not constitute a prohibited personal use of campaign contributions under the Act or Commission regulations. We have again deleted the phrase that do not increase the value of the members' homes on line 14 to 15 and instead use the phrase as described in this opinion. And then we have added more specific description of exactly what we're talking about at the what is now the top of page 5. And this is in keeping with the language that Commissioner Goodman recommended. So specifically, the Commission authorizes the use of campaign funds to pay for the installation or upgrade and monitoring costs of cameras, sensors, distress devices, and similar non-structural security devices, as well as locks, in and around a member's residences. Taking out the sentences, this guidance is prospective only unless otherwise allowed by a previous advisory opinion, residential security expenses incurred before June 2017 constitute a prohibited personal use of campaign contributions. The normal boilerplate that is in this opinion, I've been persuaded will cover us, that it always says that, you know, all of our opinions are prospective, but any person involved in any specific transaction or activity which is indistinguishable in all its material aspects from the transaction or activity with respect to which this advisory opinion is rendered may rely on this advisory opinion, which is explicitly based on the information about the current heightened threat environment experienced by members of Congress. So what we've done is we've made the kinds of improvements more specific. Explain that they will be non-structural in terms of whether how people can rely on it. People can rely on this, should it get 4 votes, going forward. people who in the past relied on past advisory opinions, which were based on specific threats to those individuals, you know, they would be covered if they were materially in a materially indistinguishable situation, they would be covered by that. So if somebody had relied on the three previous AOs and said, well, I also have experienced a specific threat and have, you know, made these changes in response to that and on the recommendation of the sergeant-at-arms, they would be covered. Now, if somebody going back through time had just decided on their own to upgrade their security without that threat, they would not be covered by those previous AOs because they would not be in a materially indistinguishable situation. And I think, you know, the reality is that should a complaint be filed, the commission will, of course, consider everything on a case-by-case basis. This is, as I've said, by its terms, limited to non-structural improvements based on the current threat environment, based on the recommendation of the sergeant at arms, and I think that is, you know, I do think that will cabinet in sufficiently for the purposes that everyone understands to be in front of us today. So I'm satisfied with this result, and I'm prepared to move approval of this document whenever Chairman deems it appropriate.
Thank you. I did have one question. What is the status of the situation in terms of the Senate? What kind of communications has there been, and have they indicated anything about this process?
I have spoken to the Senate Sergeant-at-Arms, and he's aware that I was moving forward, okay. And he certainly endorses all of the items that I'm proposing.
And he understands that the way it's being drafted, the Senate will be included?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Next, then I think we have it on the language. I'm going to move my draft B. I'm going to lose, and then I'm going to support the draft D. So I would like to move. I'll just move my own draft, and I move draft B. We approve draft B. All in favor? Me. All opposed?
No.
Okay. All in favor of draft D.
Wait.
We need a motion for draft D.
Yeah.
Do you want to make that?
Because there's actually one more change that I forgot to put in it, recommendation of counsel, and that is where we talk about the reporting. We're going to add the word reporting to make it clear we're not amending the CFR through an AO, which, of course, we could not do. We're talking about a RAD document that describes adequate purposes for reporting. So this is on page 5 in the sentence that says, the commission will add residential security expenses to its list of purposes deemed adequate for campaign disbursements. We're going to add the word reporting before purposes, so to its list of reporting purposes deemed adequate. And with that last amendment, I move approval of draft D in response to the advisory opinion request of the Sergeant-at-Arms, Paul D. Irving, which is will be advisory opinion 2017-07.
Thank you very much. Any questions, comments? All in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Mr. Chairman, we need you to announce the vote on draft B on your own motion, and then we can proceed to.
Okay. The vote was 1-4. I voted in favor, and the rest of the commissioners voted against. I thought that was obvious. Are we ready to go? All in favor of voting for draft D based upon the most recent oral changes by Commissioner Weintraub, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Good. Opposed? None. It's unanimous. Thank you very much. I admire their ingenuity to come here and put us through the system, and best of luck. And
thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. Thank you very, very much for everything. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
I really do. Thank you.
We will take up a draft advisory opinion 2017-05, Great American PAC and Committee to Defend President. Mr. Backer.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. see Council. I'd like to begin.
Thank you, Chairman Walther. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda documents 1730A and 1730B are draft responses to an advisory opinion request submitted by Great America PAC and the Committee to Defend the President. The requesters asked several questions regarding the application of the Act and Commission regulations to proposals to use Twitter handles and disclaimers on certain communications and to maintain Twitter profiles without a disclaimer. Both drafts conclude that the Great America PAC may use its Twitter handle in lieu of its full name and disclaimers, that the Committee to Defend the President may include its Twitter handle along with its full name as long as the disclaimer's language makes clear that the committee is paying for the communication, but that neither committee may use Twitter handles as an alternative to their permanent street address, telephone number, or World Wide Web address. The drafts differ in that Draft A concludes that neither committee's Twitter profile page needs to include a disclaimer, while Draft B concludes that they do. Draft B also concludes that the requesters may not satisfy the disclaimer requirement by including a graphic bearing the standard disclaimer if such graphic is not available on certain mobile devices. We did not receive any comments on the request or Draft B and one comment on Draft A. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions, comments?
Mr.
Commissioner Goodman.
I would just like to ask Mr. Backer's reaction to drafts A and B.
Well, thank you. To the extent that the drafts agree on the use of the Great America Act, Great America PAC in lieu of the name, of course we concur. To the extent that the drafts tend to agree on most other things, we're not really going to argue that, but. I do want to raise a concern about the nature of the disclaimer. Disclaimers, of course, are an important and necessary component of the disclosure regime that we have. But the purpose of the URL or the name the address or the phone number is not really informational. It's communicative, and I would be concerned that Twitter is a much more effective means of engaging in communication than the URL or the phone number or the address, and that we're looking almost at form over substance in affecting the goal of the regulations here. The address goes on the disclaimer so people can mail you a letter, not that anyone's going to come and show up at the office, hopefully. You have a phone number so they can call you. You have a URL so they can go to that website and communicate with this committee. And so the purpose isn't just to say, hey, here is this piece of information that is otherwise useless. It exists only for the purpose of engaging or allowing the viewer, the reader, the listener to engage with that political committee in some manner. And in that context, Twitter is a vastly more effective means of communication than any of those three options combined. And so I realize that the regulations say what the regulations say, and that our position would be that this would be a more effective this would better fulfill the intent of the regulation. I understand that the commission doesn't see it that way, but I think going forward that it is elevating form over substance and really not getting at the goal of what that piece of information is there for. Beyond that, I wanted to where did I put that phone? I wanted to raise the issue of whether or not we can see the disclaimers on Twitter profiles using graphics if we're required to have them. And so the concern that I had was if I go to Twitter right now and I pull up the Committee to Defend the President's Twitter profile, there is a disclaimer on the graphic. It happens to be a standard graphic that is used a lot. And it's actually the text is 4% of the vertical height of the graphic. It is in the printed box, and it is basically unreadable even to me looking at it from here. And my eyes are bad, but they're not that bad. So my concern is that with respect to the different devices, different size devices, different operating systems on devices, they all treat this differently. And so our concern is that we don't really know what device somebody's going to be using to look at a particular the Twitter page, the profile. And so it doesn't really make sense to exclude our ability if we have to have the disclaimer there. We want to be able to include it in that graphic and not have to try to measure it against something like 50 or 60 different devices and device sizes and operating systems. That said, we also don't think that the profile requires a disclaimer or that the limited amount of permissible profile space, that the 160 characters of text that we have there, should be used for the purposes of just the disclaimer. While these clients aren't using that space right now to engage in a communication, they could. And it, going into that situation, losing 86 out of 160 characters in order to create the disclaimer envisioned in draft B would be very limiting in the rest of their speech that they'd be able to engage in that very tiny space. Those are sort of the major comments. I did want to raise one other or two other mild, somewhat random issues. The first, in both drafts, on draft A, it's page 2, line 1. The draft that says, and they assert they plan to make independent expenditures. I would point out both organizations have made extensive independent expenditures this year and have done so just this week. So I don't know that I wanted to avoid any potential, like, oh, hey, it's hypothetical. These groups are very actively doing this. And then on draft A, page 8, lines 11 and 12, there's a sentence that begins, moreover, a Twitter handle, unlike a domain name, gives no information about what type of organization it references, for example, .com, .org, or .gov. I would suggest that that really is incorrect as factual matter, because other than .gov, any organization can have any domain TLD, the .com or .org that it wants. There's no restraint on it, so it doesn't really convey any information. So, for example, if I go to GoDaddy right now and I try to search for stupidregulations.gov, it'll tell me that I can't have that URL, but I can have the .com version, the .org version, .online, and you know, a long list of other different TLDs. So there's not really any the statement just happens to be factually untrue. And so I thought it would be better for the commission to strike that rather than have that in the language.
Mr. Goodman.
Just a follow-up question. That was a lot to take in.
Yeah, sorry.
Now, can you delineate, let's start then with draft A. How does draft A implicate these concerns that you've addressed? I understand the specific page 2, line 1, page 8, lines 11 to 12 issues. How are your concerns that you've addressed broadly addressed in draft A?
Well, we agree with the outcome of question one with respect to the use of the name of the organization or the Twitter handle of the organization in the lieu of the name because the Twitter handle is identical to the name absent the spacing. With respect to questions two. And well, really, I'm going to skip question two and go to question three, which is more about the use of the Twitter handle in lieu of the URL. So when we put out a communication that says, vote for against the candidate X, paid for by Act Great America PAC, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee, www.greatamericapac.com. Our approach to this is we're paying for this communication in either space or time or both. And the consumption of this space or this time is limited. We only have so much space, so much time to communicate. We're paying for it. We don't want to lose that piece of communication space, that URL. And if we have to lose that little piece of the communication, that, you know, even if it's 1 second out of 15 seconds, that's when we have a $100,000 communication, this has some real value to the organization with respect to its speech. We would, the organization, and especially the individuals who create the media content, who create TV ads, radio ads, all the different communications, who regularly yell at me over why do we have to have this disclaimer, it would be substantially beneficial to drive them to the Twitter handle. So At Great America PAC, or paid for by At Great America PAC, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee, is substantially better and a better use of donor resources than paid for by At Great America PAC, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee, www.greatamericapac.com, because it gives us 1 or 2 seconds more of communication time. And at the same time, it also is a better mechanism of engaging people with our activities. People Our experience is that people engage with this organization on Twitter. Very few people go to the website and submit an online comment or do things there. It's not, websites are essentially static because we have a Twitter profile that allows people to communicate. So both from affecting the goal of this informational disclaimer requirement, that is giving the recipient, the reader, the listener, the hearer, or viewer rather, something to engage with us, Twitter is more effective. And it would allow us to these clients to more effectively engage in communications, and it removes this even incremental but some substantial cost in terms of the space and time that they are paying to communicate their message in.
Did you want to go through the other?
We
I'm at a granular level trying to understand your reaction to the answers that are being proposed in drafts A and B, so let's start with draft A. You've been through one and three.
Mm-hmm. Well, two, I think two is sort of precatory with getting to three, whether having the name of the organization and the Twitter handle would be sufficient, was a lead into this idea that, and we don't need the URL there. Obviously, we could always put the URL, the Twitter handle in with the existing disclaimer. So we could always say, paid for by the Committee to Defend the President, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee, www.committeetodefendthepresident.com. That's about 2 seconds at my fast pace, @defend_Trump. So we could put it there. There's not a prohibition on including additional information in the box disclaimer. I see that fairly regularly. It could be elsewhere. Again, we want to minimize the portion of the mandatory text. So our goal was, hey, is this enough? And if so, then can we not have in three, can we have the Twitter completely remove the URL? In four, so if we're driving people to our Twitter page, there's not a lot of space to communicate. We've got the profile picture, we've got the header bar, we have the 160 characters, and we can put the URL in there. I think it was draft B, actually itemized it in the footnote that the disclaimer would be approximately 86 characters out of that 160 characters that would be in the box. And so if we're, again, there's a limited amount of bandwidth in which to convey this communication. It's a space question. And while right now there's not a communication going on in that space that would be supplanted, if we're required to have that disclaimer there, then it would prevent the organization from engaging in speech on this platform in that tiny little sliver of space. I tend to agree, however, with draft A that Twitter profiles don't require a disclaimer at all, but to the extent that draft B says that they do, we disagree. We would like to be able to use the graphic section that we showed and not have to worry about whether or not every individual device could read them. And that runs through questions five and, I believe, six of draft A. Keep going,
please.
On B. And so on B, the principal difference in draft B is, of course, Twitter profiles require a disclaimer. We tend to follow, as we laid out in the advisory opinion request, we think that the history here is that no, they don't, because of the nature of the Twitter profile and the way it's used. The fact that we ultimately don't have control over the content because, for example, Milo Yiannopoulos found out, if you say stuff they don't like, you're gone. And so it's not our platform. We're just sitting there. And so we don't think a disclaimer is required. And again, to the extent that it would be required, it ought to be satisfied by the use of the graphic, which frees up that potential 86 or characters out of 160, so half the potential communicative space. And again, with so many different platforms, it would be very hard for us to figure out how to construct the graphic appropriately to make it work. And I imagine there's probably even, I have iPhone model this is, but there's older ones. They may not properly render the graphic at all. We can't really control sort of the mechanics of that. So we want to create something that, if we're required to have a disclaimer, we want it to be the least obstructive possible to the potential communication and not have to try to account for every conceivable scenario that could occur.
Do I walk away with, right, understand that your principal concern with draft A is the answer to number three?
I would say that would be our biggest concern with that draft. Yes, we would encourage the commission to reconsider that its answer to that, to elevate the substance over the form.
Remind me of a fact here. Great America PAC and Committee to Defend the President, do they have street addresses?
They do.
Are they P.O. boxes?
They have street addresses. The Committee to Defend the President uses 203 South Union in Alexandria, and Great America PAC uses 107 South Lee Street, number, I think, 555. But they're the addresses that are filed on their FEC forms.
And do they have World Wide Web addresses?
They do.
They do.
Both of their full names constitute their web addresses. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, committeetodefendthepresident.com is a mouthful.
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Chairman, if I can continue.
Yes, of course.
On the one hand, we've had some disagreements here on the commission on what Twitter is, and mm-hmm. and I've tended to agree with your position that it is Twitter's platform, not yours. Mm-hmm. You control your World Wide Web address. That's yours. You control the content in it. Twitter is someone else's website mm-hmm. that controlled by the company,
yeah.
and you're there. You're allowed to use it subject to their conditions, and some of those are substantive and content conditions. So on the one hand, we're saying you're saying, so you agree with us that Twitter is not the website controlled by you.
Correct.
Okay. But you do want to use Twitter to identify you
mm-hmm.
in your sort of like that. You're saying that it is the equivalent of a World Wide Web address. So looks like there you're adopting Twitter as your identifying address to identify you.
I would think of it as a channel because we intend to have the full address of the World Wide Web address on the Twitter page, and so it'd be it's almost like going to www.nationbuilder.com/packx, mm-hmm. where it's somebody else's page, but it's a mechanism to drive. It's a channel essentially. And it ultimately, even if it by itself does not provide an adequate communicative mechanism, and I think Twitter is a much better communicative mechanism, it also links back to the ultimate web page that would still exist.
And once I land at your Twitter channel or your Twitter feed, mm-hmm. there I find your permanent street address, telephone number, or World Wide Web address posted somewhere on there?
The World Wide Web address, yes.
But not your permanent street address or telephone number?
No.
Okay. And so your concern carries on into the answer to number four as well on draft A, which is the same issue. You cannot substitute a Twitter address for a URL address.
Correct.
Go back and explain to me one more time, Dan.
Which part?
Why a URL address in a disclaimer is more onerous than a Twitter address?
Sure. There's three factors. The first is that from the perspective of the quality of a communication, we have a very limited bandwidth, whether it's space and time to communicate that message. The Twitter handle is a more effective part of the communication. It's better communicative. It's more communicative. It fits better with the branding. It allows the organization to better engage. So, for example, Accurate America PAC, or paid for by Accurate America PAC, not authorized by any candidates committee, without the URL is both shorter. So we're saving time, space, and money, which means more of the rest of the content. Even if it's just the printed disclaimer, it's only one line, but it's still that's one line less of speech. At the same time, it gives one piece of information as opposed to multiple pieces of information where we want people to go and to engage with the organization. It is substantially more communicative, which is, I think, the goal and the substance behind this particular regulation. It's not informational, it's communicative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a more effective use of this limited space that we have. Anecdotally, I can tell you, I've never had of all the ads that we approve and all the communications that we approve to make sure all the disclaimers are correct, it is an endless source of frustration for the people that are the actual creators of content that we have to put this in there. I've never met one of them who didn't say, oh, do we really have to do this? Can we just not do it? And obviously the answer is no, you have to do it, but it takes away the bandwidth and the quality of the communication. It adds to the cost. And I don't think it's as effective at delivering the value that we want, this connection between the recipient of the communication and the maker of the communication.
And you're talking about for online communications or all communications?
I think really all communications, whether it's TV, radio, print.
And you use Twitter instead of URL on all of those.
Yeah, we would like to. So we encourage a global, an overly inclusive global disclaimer from all of our clients. And we that way, in the off chance that somebody decides, hey, let's use this disclaimer here because the lawyer's not around right now and we need to get it done, we have an over-inclusive disclaimer. So across the board, we want to be able to advise this is what you use so we know it fits in every scenario. Even if it might not technically be required in one particular place, if we can do it, we want to do it.
Okay. On devices, which you mentioned, I understand the character limitation.
Right.
Okay. We have a small items exemption mm-hmm. that from time to time has been debated on the commission for disclaimers on devices. Mm-hmm. But for television and print and direct mail, how is it that your communication is somehow impinged upon if you have to use the URL as opposed to a Twitter? When, mm-hmm. so long as you provide the URL or the permanent street address, you could always add your Twitter handle as well. I mean, you're not across media. This does not impinge upon space for communication across all media, does it?
I would say that it does. First, so there's two different requests.
Hold on, but I got to challenge that. Okay. You send a direct mail piece.
Uh-huh.
Requires a disclaimer.
Mm-hmm.
The commission insists on the plain language of its mm-hmm. statute and regulations and says you got to use a street address, telephone number, or World Wide Web address. And by the way, if you want to add your Twitter handle somewhere in there, you can. But you have unlimited space pretty much in a direct mail piece. I mean, this adding the URL address is not going to squeeze out any communicative content in a direct mail piece.
Granted, but the quality of the communication suffers because at www.thecommitteetodefendthepresident.com is a very long URL, and people don't engage in the internet the way they do now. Giving people at defend_Trump both better conveys the intent and the message and the goal of the organization, as well as provides a better and more effective means of communication. And given the option
not
between one channel or two, but we want to channel them into the one. If
I get it, but you want to channel people. I see.
Right. To the most effective form of communication. So if we have to have, if we're going to put both of them there, that's going to, that is consuming some space. Now, granted, it's a very limited amount of space. It's much more of an issue when we're talking about oral disclaimers or screen and print disclaimers.
Well, screen and print, I understand. I don't think we have fully fleshed out the potential application of the small items exemption here, which has been a point of some debate on the commission. And I might, Mr. Chairman, want a little more time to consider that issue if we distinguish between media.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're looking at channeling as a practical matter, we could have you comply with our act, it seems to me, provide a street address, which doesn't really channel anybody anywhere in the
right.
in the cyber world, and you could always add your Twitter handle for the channel. The channeling only comes if you feel compelled to use your URL address. Then you say to me, you're forcing me to channel people to my URL address when I prefer to channel them to my web presence at Twitter. My point is, for other media, such as print media, mm-hmm. adding the Twitter as an add-on, there's no prohibition as to that. So how much? I understand the space limitations on characters online, okay, but for other media, it doesn't seem to me we are eliminating the room for communicative content.
It's not eliminating the room, but if the goal is to have a uniform model of communication so that everyone receives essentially the same disclaimer information so that it's uniform across recipients, and we want to have the Twitter handle there because it's the most effective means of communication, and so we have the Twitter handle and some other mechanism of communication in the disclaimer, whether it's the address or the URL. So now we've got two different pieces. Which one does the recipient of the communication choose?
Yes.
Obviously, we wanted them to use the one main communication model that is most likely to affect the communication. It doesn't squeeze out the 18 or 20, however many characters of ink that's of used there. I agree that it's not really taking up space, but it affects the quality and the character of the communication and the ability to effectively engage with that audience. Like, the goal
isn't that an argument that people have made about disclaimers all along? That they somehow force us to speak in a certain way, and they somehow
I mean, yeah. You know,
and I would
we do have a disclaimer
agree with the validity of that. But it's the regulation does require it, and it is an important part of the system that we have to have disclaimers so people know who's speaking.
Yes.
And through the street address, phone number, or URL, a mechanism to contact that speaker, in which I think the Twitter handle is optimal. There's also, I think, in terms of the clarity and the ability for the non-lawyered up political organization to have, a simpler rule is probably the better rule. And that being able to say, or your Twitter handle, you can use your Twitter handle here, but not here or here, adds a layer of complexity to these activities. As I'm sure you know, there's been an explosion in the amount of grassroots political speech in the, you know, the small and mid-dollar range over the last several years, and there's a lot of people who are engaging in political activity who don't have lawyers and are reading the 2008 copy of the Non-Connected Committee Guide out there and not really sure what that requires of them.
Mr. Chairman, for your indulgence.
Of course.
Dan, I apologize. I didn't reread your request for today's meeting. Was it clear in your request that you were asking about this use of Twitter versus URL in your disclaimer across all media of communication?
I don't know that we specified it in that language, but I do. But we did ask to, instead of the URL, just use the Twitter handle. So I would say it would probably be implied, not explicit.
Well, it's just striking me now that there may be different results depending on the media that you are using. And as to non-uniformity, I mean, there is a position on this commission that there could be non-uniformity, i.e. in the sense that in print, you'd have to have the full disclaimer, and on a device, you might not have to have a disclaimer at all because it's a small item, and that's non-uniformity. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll defer to any other questions, but I might want to take a little more time with the permission of Mr. Backer.
Of course.
Happy to grant to defer an outcome on this if that's helpful to the commission. I don't think we're up against the time clock either.
All right. Well, I wouldn't mind having a little more time to consider it myself, to be honest with you. Mr. Peterson.
Just one quick question. And I think taking a little bit of extra time to just look at this is probably not a bad idea. Even if one's sympathetic with the argument that you're making, the problem we run into is the specificity of the statutory language, which it could have been written differently, and it's sometimes that's the problem when statutory language is written so specifically in light of the technologies and available means of communication at the time. But it does say that for non-authorized communications, it shall clearly state the name and permanent address, telephone number, or worldwide web address of the person who paid for the communication, and state that the communication is not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. No, there's no catch-all or some equivalent signifier or designation. So in terms of the specificity of the statutory language, how does the commission get out of that box and move beyond and start considering other pieces of information as meeting the commands of this language?
So the first thing that occurs to me is bit.ly, bit.ly. Are you familiar with this? So it's link shortening. So, for example, yeah. I can own www.thecommitteetodefendthepresident.com. I can go to bit.ly, and that's the whole URL. Enter that URL in there. They'll give me a short URL. Mm-hmm. It'll be 123, I'm making this up, but 123456 dot bit.ly. That, if I put that URL into our disclaimer, that is that directly takes you to the URL, and it would constitute a URL, an appropriate use of the disclaimer. But no one would want to do that because it's meaningless gibberish, these short URLs. So the advance of technology has broadened what is the World Wide Web. When the World Wide Web was written in this context, you didn't have Twitter. I don't think you had Facebook. I didn't think you had a lot of this stuff. You just had message boards and discussion platforms and emails. And I think the commission need not elevate the specificity of the language written at a time before any of this technology existed and became tremendously dominant in our political communications process. As a principal means of communication in a lot of industries and amongst people generally, I don't think you're bound to only look at it that way. It would be like, say, I'm trying to think of a really good analogy, and I can't come up with one, but I think there are plenty of examples where this commission has, in light of the evolving technology, has said, look, this may have been the specific statutory language, but we see this inclusive of this language. You know, in fact, the commission just now said created a new descriptive category for appropriate reporting purposes for home security systems that would, you know, that would have been outside the scope of the statute. But it understood that, look, times have changed. We need to recognize that, and that this is a reasonable understanding within the confines of the language. I think here as well, what is the World Wide Web has dramatically changed, and I think it is. The commission has the ability to recognize those that evolution, those changes within this context.
Okay. Oh, go ahead. No. I was just going to say that if there is some additional time granted with this, I don't mind puzzling over this a little bit longer.
Mr. Goodman?
Well, Dan, while we have you, and we can discuss this in public, I guess the concern I have following up on the statutory language that Commissioner Peterson just mentioned is, and by the way, I'm sympathetic to the result that you're trying to get at, but we are bound by our statutory language, okay? But just hear me out. What you're asking for is for us to redefine what URLs are on the World Wide Web so that political committees can say, go to someone else's website, Twitter's, to find out more about me. I mean, because in you like our answers, you like the proposed answers in draft A to the subsequent questions that conclude Twitter is not your own website and therefore, under a strict reading of our regulations, you don't have to post a disclaimer there. Mm-hmm. You like that, and I think you accept our theory for that, which is, it's not your website. You don't control it. It's Twitter's website, okay? But now you're asking us to expand the notion of what a URL is on the World Wide Web to somebody else's website, which is Twitter's website. Now, maybe we should recognize the developments of technologies and change our regulation that way, but it strikes me in the meantime we've got a statute that says it. Your website identifies you, and therefore, in the interest of disclaimers and informing people who is speaking, you need to direct them to your address or your URL. That is the web presence that you own and control. So react to that. What I'm seeing is a bit of an inconsistency in asking us to now broaden the definition of a URL as your identifier.
So if a bit.ly would be an acceptable mechanism as a URL, that's not that distinct from Twitter other than the fact that there's a static intermediary versus a direct channel. Because I don't own bit.ly, they own it. They could change it anytime they want and not tell me about it. So I think if a bit.ly would work, and I think most people would say that it could, or any link shortener, then really Twitter is just a static intermediary version of that. And then I had a wonderful thought that popped into my head here when you were describing this. With respect to the Twitter. Darn it. You know when you have that wonderful point?
Well, I guess I have another question, and so maybe it'll come to you. Happens to me all the time. My wife's here today, and I can tell you, she'll tell you I have early onset dementia. Let me ask you, I just want to test a theory with you. Mm-hmm. What if the answer is through all traditional media, non-digital, including your own website, you got to use the permanent street address, telephone number, or World Wide Web address in the box disclaimer, the traditional box disclaimer, because our statute says so. You can always add in your preferred in that box or anywhere else, you can add in learn more about us at, and then post to channel people to your Twitter account rather than your main URL if you're interested in channeling people there, okay? And then as for device, for electronic and small electronic communications, it seems to me that perhaps no disclaimers required under the small items exemption.
So
with the first part of that, the idea of, and learn more about us here. In my conversation with the professional communicators who create all these communications, they'll say that you want to have, if you want to be effective, you have to have one message, one ask. You don't want to just diverge from that. And every sort of interruption or hiccup you put in that way is going to cost you some number of responses. I think somebody, I once heard this, that if for every additional click you have to do to get to a place, it's 3% loss rate. Having information that is not absolutely essential, that is neither part of the message nor essential to that message, is distracting from the core of that message. I get that we are required to have this disclaimer.
Problem you're indicating is inherent in having to have a disclaimer generally.
Right.
If I'm talking to the communications specialist, I might say, use the street address, which isn't going to channel anybody anywhere. And then use or the phone number.
But we want them to communicate with us. We don't want them not to.
And then add the Twitter feed to be the one place where people can communicate with us online.
So, and this gets back to the idea that popped into my head before, and you just sort of mentioned again, is that the purpose of the disclaimer is to identify the speaker, and we agree. And the speaker is identified by the paid-for-by portion of the disclaimer. The URL portion of the disclaimer, or the phone number, or the address, is the communicative part of it. It's about, and here's how you get a hold of us. So it's, here's who we are, and here's how you can get a hold of us. And in the Committee to Defend the President's case, those are sort of two separate pieces. In Great America's case, that's one unified piece of messaging. So the identity component isn't what we're challenging. Obviously, you know, every communicator would love to not have to put anything in there that didn't actually communicate their message hands-on. We have to identify the speaker. But then in identifying the seeker, and that it's an independent communication, it's not authorized by a candidate, and here's how you get a hold of us, the least... having one option that is as uniform as possible is the best. And having one option rather than giving people multiple places to go is the best for the quality of the communication. And to some limited extent, depending on the media, the time and space component involved, it also drives all the communications to one place, which is ultimately better. If I only have to pick up one response channel versus multiple ones, that's generally a good in the communicative space. And it achieves the objective of that component of the disclaimer requirement, which is not an identity component. It's a here's how you get a hold of me component.
Yes.
So I think that's the differentiation. So we're not really arguing that you have to identify yourself. It's who you have to. And now here's the part we're going to shoot myself a little in the foot, unfortunately.
I would advise you as counsel not to do that.
The problem with the small items of exemption is that I can differentiate. If you're going to if I send you an email and you click on it, whether you're on a mobile device or a desktop device, I can control what page you hit, and that allows that might address the small items problem. I can't do that with Twitter. You're going to one Twitter. Twitter doesn't let me change your experience based on your platform. I can tell you that the substantial and growing majority of utilization of political communications across all the different groups that I see, it's mobile. More and more people, it's already the majoritarian methodology. Desktop, laptops are going away. It's devices like cell phones or iPhones and tablets are substantially predominating, and it grows every single year by leaps and bounds. And so, unfortunately, there's so much, fortunately, there's a lot of diversity in that marketplace, so there's not really a way. Our approach to the small items exemption is really to the extent that we have the graphic there. So it's not that we want to be exempted from the disclaimer. If we have to have a disclaimer, we don't want to be exempted from it. Rather, if we have to have a disclaimer, we want to be able to do it in the graphic, regardless of whether it would apply for the small items. But even though, as a practical matter, I can look at this thing and I can't read what that says right now on our page. It's just a little bit too much, or rather, too small.
Mr. Chairman,
it's complex.
No, I appreciate the observations, and I'd like to consider what Mr. Backer's points a little bit longer. I will just indicate this. Disclaimers for 40 years or more now, we've heard the arguments that they distort people's message. There's forced speech. It takes up space. Takes up space in radio ads. I think it's an open question about where a disclaimer might take up the entire communicative space of a small item or a radio ad that might be a 10-second radio ad, and whether you even have space, whether it crowds out the whole message. I don't know that we're dealing with that here, and so I would like a little bit more time.
to consider the points that he has made, and so also the distinctions between the types of communications his committees may be considering, because I think there may be other regulatory implications that I hadn't thought of regarding the required disclaimer, for example, in small digital print.
Fair enough. Any objections? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick comment. I'm not intending to launch into a prolonged back and forth on this. I just want to, because we're going to be coming back to this issue, I can tell. I just want to state for the record that Commissioner Goodman is absolutely correct. We are bound by the statute to have certain disclaimers. I think we could potentially consider in a rulemaking context whether we can reinterpret some of those requirements. I'm not sure if we can, if we have that authority in the digital environment, or whether we want to make legislative recommendations. And it might be interesting, even if we were talking about legislative recommendations, to seek public comment, perhaps have a hearing. You know, this could be a very interesting topic. However, we currently have statute and rules on the books, and those are the ones that we have to apply. I am my plan is, you know, although we're not going to vote today, my current plan is to support draft B. The major difference is goes to whether a Twitter platform is your own web page or not. You know, unless you're Mark Zuckerberg, you're always on somebody else's platform. And whether it's Facebook or Twitter or whatever, I think that really these platforms, particularly, you know, Twitter, where people can have handles that are completely obscure. You know, you get no way of knowing who these people are, and they have these funny animal pictures as their avatars, and, you know, you just don't know. I think it's particularly important to have some kind of disclaimer requirement, which is completely feasible. It's completely feasible for these requesters. That's why we did the character count. You know, yes, in a hypothetical world where you had some other client or this client decided to change their current Twitter profile page, it might raise, you might have fewer characters, but, you know, you come to us with a specific request and we interpret it under the facts that are given to us, which includes the status of your current platform profile page. So I think it's not actually terribly onerous, and that's sort of where I'm going with that, and I don't think I really need to say much else at this point since we're all going to come back to it.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Becker, is there anything further for today anyway?
I would just briefly note that, you know, as both drafts recognize, the Internet has completely changed the nature of political communications and really all communications, and that Twitter is an incredibly powerful platform by which we engage in political debate. And while I've been sitting here, Michael Beckel in the back has tweeted, Dan Becker of @political_lawdb, @GreatAmericanPacTreasures, arguing using Twitter handle would save space, enable more speech/content. People use Twitter to engage in the political discussion, and we really ought to encourage it rather than not. So, and I hope he retweets that. So,
all right, fair enough. Thanks very much. We'll continue this at some other time. How about an hour and a half? We'll come back at 2:30. 2:30 to 4. Fair enough. Give us an hour and a half in the afternoon. All right. Good afternoon, everyone. This is to resume the open session that we began this morning. And the next item is proposed interim enforcement policy on volunteer mail exemption. And there's two memoranda. And all I can say is that I was asked by the vice chair to agree to her draft. And not surprisingly, I said, maybe. But what I really meant is I'll work with you. And so in the time amount that we had left, I put together a draft that was picked up with a number of concerns we've had. It's been a while since it's been a while since we've been on this issue, to identify some of the issues that were still at odds then. And what I have agreed with the vice chair is that in the meantime, we'll work on another draft that moves toward theirs and see if we can't begin to get some headway on a number of things. So that's the status of that issue at the point from my perspective. Madam Vice Chair?
So I should put my speech away?
Let me read it first.
I'm happy to hear that, Mr. Chair, and I do look forward to working with you. Thank you for your willingness to do so. I was going to, you know, talk about this for a little bit longer, but I'll truncate my remarks just to say that we had an open audit hearing a few weeks ago of the Colorado Republican Committee, and once again we're reminded of the fact that the public and our own lawyers and auditors told us in a public session that they really don't even know what standards to apply to the volunteer mail exemption. And so it's causing a lot of concern and wasted effort, wasted time on the part of both the people who work here in the audit division in OGC and also people who are trying to implement this exemption in the state parties. We have six audits right now in the building that deal with this issue, and they're both Republican committees and Democrat committees, and I'm hoping that we can resolve this soon so we don't have to, again, waste everybody's time, and it's an issue that we should be able to come up with an agreement on. So thank you for your willingness to work together, and we'll go from there.
Okay, I pointed out that the applicable word on her part is give. So, you know,
Got it.
The next matter is proposed interim enforcement discussion of commission's response to alleged foreign interference with American elections. And this is a matter that's continued from a previous matter. It's something that the Commissioner Weintraub has, these various issues, has raised frequently and sometimes with a loud voice, and has gained a lot of attention, and I think this should provide for an interesting conversation. But I do want to say this, that a number of the things that are subject to some of the things that I've read, and given the situation that exists in this country right now with respect to a number of these issues, and given the fact that we're asked to have matters before us that deal with some or all of them, I'm hoping that we can keep our conversation sufficiently distant from any contention that we've got any particular either predilection toward one position or another, or versus guilt or innocence, or is it right or wrong, but mostly just to go forward on discussions of some of these issues as best we can. The my thought would be there's six items in discussing it with Commission Weintraub, and what I'd like to do is take each one separately and have a separate discussion on that within a reasonable period of time, not trying to reach agreement necessarily, but to see where we might find some common ground or some basis for movement and that kind of thing. I want to commend her for the time she's put in all this. It's always good to get rousted off our soft pedestal once in a while, and this is certainly helping to do that. There was a couple things that I thought I'd like to ask first to address, and that so let me just go ahead. Of the six, the one is provide public assurances on FEC data integrity, and I say that because we've, since that last meeting, you know, amongst ourselves, have learned a lot about where we are and where we've come from and where we want to go and that kind of thing. So I just invite the Commissioner Weintraub to address what she sees at this point after some of the new information that we've had.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that is an excellent place to start because we've already made some progress on that front, and I very much appreciate that. There isn't a lot that we can say publicly about it at this point, but I do want to say that we have already received one briefing from our staff on where we stand vis-a-vis IT security, and there is an effort underway to draft something that we could share with the public. Obviously, there are aspects of our IT security that we cannot it would not be prudent for us to share with the public, but I do think that there is something that we can say on this, and we're working on it, and I very much appreciate that. As far as I know, everybody's pretty much on board, both with our assuring ourselves that we're in a good place vis-a-vis IT security, and also with our trying to find a way of framing the issue that we could share with the public.
And there's the rub, especially when it comes to security issues. So thank you very much, and that did prompt us to take a good look at where we are, and we learned from that request. There's another one that I would ask you to maybe take a look at, and that's to just examine the commission's enforcement function and see if you have any thoughts, if you want to start a conversation on that topic, number two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to sort of frame this because there are some overall comments that will apply really with respect to all of this. I think this is a great opportunity for the Commission to take on an issue that is of great concern to the public. I thought it was great this morning. I appreciate those of you who have hung in here and have come back after lunch and are still here with us. We had a long meeting this morning, and we managed to resolve our differences on at least one matter that people came into the room. They weren't in the same place, but we worked hard on it, and we came to a unanimous conclusion that I think was a good result, and I think that's a great model, and I hope that we can continue working together. And I want to be very clear that these issues that I'm talking about are all, I want to discuss them in a prospective manner. I'm worried about the 2018 election. Nothing that would come of any of these proposals would affect anyone who did or didn't do anything in the 2016 election. We're talking about rulemakings. We're talking about other paths forward that would all be prospective. And my concern is that given everything that we have learned already and continue to learn, and I think this is not a partisan issue. Nikki Haley, the ambassador to the UN, said on July 8th, everybody knows that they're not just meddling in the United States election. They're doing this across multiple continents, and they're doing this in a way that they're trying to cause chaos within the countries. John McCain, also on July 9th, on Face the Nation, said that the Russian President Vladimir Putin got away with trying to change the result of the 2016, trying to change, I'm not saying he did change, the 2016 U.S. presidential election. He said, we know that Russia tried to change the outcome of our election last November, and they did not succeed, but there was really sophisticated attempts to do so. And in his words, so far they have not paid a single price for that. Now, we're not talking about prices.
Let me take a moment. This is precisely the concern I have about moving even quotes about people that in theory could be involved in our enforcement procedure. And I think if it was a way to avoid having to do that, we can still cover the same ground. I'm concerned about that. Council, I don't know what your thought is on that.
I appreciate that, Mr. Thanks. Chairman. I will bear that in mind. The point that I was trying to make is that this does not have to be and should not be a partisan issue, that there are Republicans as well as Democrats who are concerned about
and independents.
And independents. And no doubt Libertarians and Green Party members and all sorts of other folks who are concerned about what has happened and what may happen in the future. And I think it's really important for us to try to grapple with some of these issues, as I said, on a prospective basis, so that we don't find ourselves, we're only 16 months out from the next election. It is not that far away. Within a few months, you know, things are going to be getting hot and heavy for the 2018 election. And I really don't want us to find ourselves 2 years from now looking back and saying, well, you know, despite everything that we read in the newspaper, we decided to delay taking any proactive action, and then we find ourselves facing a new round of allegations coming out of the 2018 election. And that's what I would like us to work towards, trying to avoid, towards taking whatever steps we can to try and address whatever issues are out there or that we can foresee, and to close any loopholes that we know about or that we can find out about. And I think that the key first step really is information gathering. This is certainly an issue in which the government should be all on the same page and all working towards the same goal. There are obviously any number of investigations going on, and there's no need for us to recreate the wheel. I would like to see us request briefings, both in public and, if need be, in private, about what other folks in government are learning, so that we can inform ourselves and be in the best position to assess whether there are steps that we could take to tighten our rules, to ward off future problems. And I think, you know, I would love to see our legal staff meet with some of the career prosecutors over at the Justice Department who work on putting together cases, again, on a prospective basis. I'm not talking about anything that I think we need to inform ourselves to the best of our abilities about what has already happened so that we can put ourselves in the best position to examine our prospective activity. So I'd like to see our lawyers talk to prosecutors and find out whether there are aspects of our rules that they think it would behoove us to change that would make their jobs easier going forward. Again, none of that would affect anybody who is already engaged in any conduct, because the rulemakings are always prospective. So I would like to see us seek out that information, and if need be, if we need to get security clearances in order to receive that information, then I think we should seek that out. To the best of my knowledge, and I'm pretty sure about this, we currently have nobody on staff who has a security clearance. I think that would be an excellent thing to add to our enforcement toolbox.
But if you did, who would the person talk to?
What?
I said, if you did, who would the person talk to?
You
walk down the hall with a security clearance and you can't talk to anybody.
I think we'd probably need to have more than one person. But, you know, we might want to have a small number of people in our Office of General Counsel get security clearances so that if there were to be matters that were presented to us that required that level of security in order to find out what happened, we would have people on board who could handle that. So I think that is a key element of our enforcement function that I'd like to see us pursue. And I think, you know, commissioners might need to get security clearances if we wanted to get the kind of briefings that I would hope that we could get. Although I think that there is also probably some public information that we could avail ourselves of. We could ask people from Treasury to better inform us about how, to their knowledge, foreign governments move money around, foreign nationals move money around. I'm well aware that in this country people have a nice organized banking system, and, you know, when this has come up when I've talked to people from other countries, that, you know, we're able to audit our political parties and our political committees because pretty much all of our financial transactions are done through banks, and they're done, you know, with credit cards or through electronic transfers, and these things are all traceable. That isn't the way every other country is organized. So I think, you know, it would probably benefit us to get more information about that. I would like to see us revisit some of the rulemaking proposals that I have previously suggested, and I'm not going to rehash all of them, but the one that I would most like to see us revisit, it's, you know, sort of the narrowest approach, and I'm happy to augment this with any other suggestions that anybody else has, but I think given the ingenuity that other countries may be employing and trying to influence our elections, I think it would behoove us to try and adopt some kind of a certification procedure where people who are spending money on the kind of political activity that requires disclosure to us would have to certify that they were not receiving their money to the extent that they aren't already disclosing all of their donors. Some of the political activity that gets disclosed to us is not from people who disclose all their donors. I would like to see certifications that those entities are not getting their money from entities that are owned or controlled by foreign governments. You know, we can put aside for another day, because I understand they're very controversial, some of the corporate proposals that I've made that look at percentage of ownership and how many foreign nationals are on the board. I would love to address them, but if I get it, if people don't want to do that, but I would really love to know if, you know, based on all of the new information that we have learned in the last 7 months since I last brought up my rulemaking proposals, if there would be any interest at all in trying to do a rulemaking that would look into whether that kind of a certification could be adopted, because I just don't know why, regardless of whether an entity is incorporated in this country and potentially run or managed by a U.S. citizen, I think if it is owned or controlled by a foreign government, you know, put aside other foreign nationals, just foreign, let's just focus on foreign governments, because that is the thing that I think has most people most concerned right now. I would like to see whether maybe there's been any change of heart as to whether that might be a good idea to pursue through a rulemaking. And again, as we inform ourselves through all of these mechanisms, I think that we may find that there are things that we can't do through rulemakings that may require statutory change, and I look forward to working with my colleagues on potential legislative recommendations in that regard. And I also would encourage, I've heard from so many people in the public, and I so appreciate all of the emails and tweets and the other contacts that I've had from people who really would have been urging us to take some action in this regard. If there are people out there who have ideas about you know, particular rulemakings or legislative recommendations or other steps that they would like to see the agency to take, I welcome those suggestions. You know, feel free to file your very own petition for rulemaking, but even if you have less developed ideas and just some thoughts, I really am so pleased to hear from so many people and continue to welcome that feedback. So I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I know you wanted to do this issue by issue, but since there were sort of themes that ran through the entire topic, I thought it might be easier to just kind of talk about it more.
Go for it. I understand. Well, I think going back to that, unless you want to proceed differently, I think we should try and cover those 6 points, since at least we can say we did look at those and got feedback with a little more particularity. So let me just ask you, when you talk about revised corporate rulemaking, we're basically talking about certification at this point.
That's what I'm asking for at this point. As I said, I've put any number of suggestions out there, as have you, Mr. Chairman, over the years, on how we might better address the potential for foreign money to come in through the corporate structure. While I'm happy to consider any or all of them, I thought if I just kind of focused in on what I think is the narrowest proposal, and in light of I guess it's a question for my colleagues. I know the last time I proposed it, there were not four votes for it, so I just, in light of everything that we have learned in the last 7 months, thought I'd just ask again if there is any increased interest in addressing that issue or anything similar to it.
Commissioner Goodman?
Vice Chair.
I took that as a question, so let me answer a question with a question. The last time I proposed a certification mechanism for the commission, it couldn't garner four votes. So has there been a change of opinion on the certification mechanism that I proposed twice and that died by 3-3 votes twice?
What I would propose is that we put them both out as we frequently do in the rulemaking context. We could put out alternative proposals.
How would yours alter from mine?
My proposal is, it's not the document I have right at my fingertips right now, is that we would require a certification from political spenders that they did not get money from a company, any entity, regardless of whether it is incorporated in this country. It could be a domestic subsidiary. It could have a, nominal leader who is an American citizen. But if that entity is owned or controlled by a foreign government, again, I'm focusing just on foreign governments at the moment, that we would require a certification from political spenders that they were not accepting money from those sources. And that is the difference.
The certification you're suggesting, and by the way, I understood your prior proposals to be much broader than that.
I know. I'm trying to narrow it down.
Okay. So now I'm trying to understand, because I haven't seen a narrowed version in writing. And so just so that I understand what we're at least discussing, is your proposal that anyone's making, for example, a regulated political expenditure or a contribution to a super PAC, at the time of making that expenditure or contribution would have to certify none of the funds that I am spending were received by a foreign national, received from a foreign national? Is that the certification? Because that sounds very close to ours.
No, it would go beyond that. It would that too, but also that there none of the funds were coming from any entity that is owned or controlled by a foreign government. Now, if you believe that is already covered, maybe we could do this in an interpretive ruling. Maybe it doesn't require. Because I want the certification, and that would require an additional rulemaking.
And are you talking about wholly owned by a foreign government, or would any percentage of shareholder ownership, such as a Norwegian sovereign fund, be covered as well? If the sovereign fund of Norway owned 4% of an American public company, publicly traded company, what would the certification be in that case?
Owned or controlled. And, we would...
Does partial ownership of 4% of a company's stock count?
Well, I think that's something that we would flesh out in a rulemaking, but that's not actually what I'm not pushing for that.
Okay, I'm trying to understand. You asked us a question. I'm trying to...
Well, when I get into the percentages, then people get nervous. We could start with, 100%, wholly owned, and then we could consider, 90%, 75%, 50%. I'm happy to consider any any alternatives. I'm willing to, as you know, in previous proposals, I've looked at percentages as low as 5%. I'm willing to, stick with 50% and above. How about that? I'm trying to narrow it down to a place where I think we could make a little progress, and would not cover the world.
And how would you square that definition of what you're essentially doing would be interpreting foreign national, because the statutory prohibition we have is that a foreign national cannot make a contribution or expenditure in connection with an American election.
Correct.
For office.
Directly or indirectly, yes.
Right. Okay. So how, when you you are reinterpreting the scope of foreign nationals to prohibit, I take it your proposal would be to then prohibit any American company that has 50% ownership by a foreign government from making, from funding American electoral expenditures. Is that, that's what I
would like to put that out for.
And it could be 5%,
yep.
Could be 50%, could be 100%. You're flexible on where we draw that line. Okay.
That is the rulemaking process. It's a line drawing exercise.
Now let me ask you, how do you square that interpretation, that reinterpretation of foreign national to a percent ownership basis, with the definition of foreign principal in the Foreign Agents Registration Act?
It would address the definition of owned or controlled. You know, we would be defining what it means to own or control by a foreign government.
Yes, but what you're still doing, owned or controlled by a foreign national. The prohibition is as to foreign nationals, and we have a definition of what foreign national is. And nowhere in our law, our FICA interprets foreign national to be coextensive with the definition of foreign principal in the Foreign Agents Registration Act. The Foreign Agents Registration Act nowhere defines foreign principal according to the percentage ownership of the American corporation. And so I'm asking, because it could be a non-starter just as a legal principle, but it might form the basis of a legislative recommendation that perhaps Congress should reconsider the definition of foreign principal under the FARA. But I'm asking, how do I square a new... Now, by the way, we know Congress has the ability to define corporations and to restrict their activities according to percentage ownership, because Congress has done so in other statutes. Indeed, in the Foreign Agents Registration Act, Congress defined foreign agents to, in some cases, include press entities that have over 20% foreign ownership. So even in the Foreign Agents Registration Act itself, Congress knows how to draw percentage ownerships to draw distinctions between foreign agents and principals versus domestic companies. I can say that, you know, there's a sympathetic ring to what you say about 100% foreign owned. I'm not sure it's permitted by the statute. So I will agree here at the table publicly to investigate this issue with you further. I have looked at this previously, and I keep running into the definition of foreign principal in the Foreign Agents Registration Act. So in the meantime, 2 points. Three commissioners have voted for a certification mechanism within the grain of our current statute and definitions, and the body of law that has been created defining what a foreign national is, and the conditions under which a U.S. company that may be publicly traded, under which it can spend money in American politics. And that proposal still stands as a mechanism to shore up the risk. Bob Linhard wrote about this not long ago at Covington and Burling. And he called this proposal a constructive proposal, given the risk that some people might be cheating the existing current laws. And so my offer to look at that still stands as well. And I extend that to the other side of the table. But more broadly, the circumstances raised in your memo, and that's how, for counsel's sake, I will try to refer to these, do not implicate the misuse of American companies to make unlawful contributions or expenditures in the form of contributions through American corporate entities, the funneling of money. We saw that. We've seen that in numerous cases. And the Commission has a long history of enforcing the foreign national ban when foreign nationals tried to funnel money through corporate entities, including LLCs, into the United States. Certainly in the context before Citizens United, when corporations could give it the state and local level, as well as the soft money accounts of the parties. So the Commission has a whole body of law and a track record of detecting and enforcing the misuse of corporate entities in the United States where foreign nationals try to put money through them into American politics. There's a list of at least nearly a dozen cases, including the 1996 cases involving the Democratic National Committee. So we know we have a track record of enforcing that in the corporate. But what we are reading about in your memo today and what we're reading about in the press writ large is a very different form of participation in American politics. And I don't have to talk about any particular country. What your memo implicates and what we're reading about is criminal hacking of American computers. And our Department of Justice has been indicting foreign people on foreign soil for hacking into American computer systems in many cases. For many years now. And there are laws against hacking. I don't know how we get into the hacking of databases in the United States for political objectives and then dumping materials on popular websites that are foreign, hosted in foreign countries, but accessible by American citizens. I don't know how we get from that current issue, which is the subject of your memo, to just addressing the misuse of the corporate entity in the United States as the solution to the current issues raised in your memo and that we're reading about. So let me address more broadly that the issues raised in your memo are quite important. And I think everybody here acknowledges we don't need tweet storms to impress upon us the importance of the issues that are before us. But we do have a law enforcement mechanism for addressing the issues that are raised in your memo. And for those purposes, I do agree with you that we need to do more fact-finding before we undertake to respond to the issues raised in your memo as a policy matter, even prospectively. I think we need to do more fact-finding. And there are at least a dozen committees of both houses of Congress and other sister agencies of ours who are performing either investigations or fact findings into the issues raised in your memo right now. And I agree with you. We ought to have lines of communications open, particularly with our sister agencies. And so I take that as a highly constructive proposal. And I think, I don't speak for all my colleagues, I don't think there's any resistance to open up lines of communication with other agencies. Where I think we may disagree is I believe this should be done through the ordinary mechanisms and procedures we have in our enforcement process. We have a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Justice. We have a track record of communications. This is exactly, if you look at the record of the 1996 DNC scandal involving Chinese money coming into the United States, there are many written communications and there were many meetings in the enforcement context, information sharing between the Department of Justice and this agency. So when these types of issues come up, I think the enforcement mechanisms we have in place are well-trod, tested, and they protect the information security. We're talking about clearances, for example. I think other agencies are far more likely to deal with this agency if we handle them in a prudent or prudential manner in our enforcement way, rather than suggesting that we're going to be holding public hearings and we want public briefings by them on the facts that they're finding out, or that, you know, we're here with an MSNBC news crew in tow. So I think we need to handle
this. News crew here? I must have missed that.
Well, or that we have Alt-FEC accounts that tweet this type of information out. So I think we can handle these issues that you approaches that you discuss in the context of our normal enforcement procedures and mechanisms. We are, you know, at bottom a law enforcement agency, and the issues raised in your memo fundamentally call upon us to respond in a very responsible and prudential way to them. And as for moving from that to prospective policymaking, I think we need to do more fact-finding, as you said. We don't need to recreate that wheel to do all of that ourselves, but we need to continue the information gathering. Now, I personally have been reading, I've read the intelligence report that's a public report that was requested by President Obama and issued in January, and I've read other reports issued by the Department of Homeland Security, and I've even read other documents and reports by the Center for Strategic International Studies. And so all of us, yes, should continue to inform what we do prospectively. But I think much of that, if you want it to be tailored to any demonstrated threats we currently face in the world, I think we ought to do significant fact-finding in our enforcement context to do that. I think we also need to acknowledge going into this the complexity of the issues we face in a modern technological world where American citizens and American journalists have at their fingertips to bring to bear their own opinions foreign material posted by foreign sources on websites, whether that be social media websites, whether that be WikiLeaks, because in a world of ubiquitous information where every American has access to foreign information, wherever it is posted, including foreign press accounts, getting at the issues raised in your memo are going to be far more complicated than just requiring certification of the use of American corporate resources. And if we're going to be responsive to the issues raised in your memorandum, I think the issues raised on how influence can be brought to bear on the public opinion of American citizens, hold aside hacking of voter databases or anything like that, which is outside our jurisdiction, these are going to be very complicated issues. And they are also going to implicate the First Amendment rights of American citizens to access that information. We just had a Supreme Court decision this month out of North Carolina where the Supreme Court said citizens have a First Amendment right not just to speak online but to access information online. And this was a 9-0 opinion with a very broad opinion written by 5 justices. So before we leap into this, I think we should mind, I understand the excitement that we're seeing in the press. I think we need to group as a law enforcement agency primarily and then find where there may be holes after all of that fact-finding is done. There are many historical examples of overreaction by government to foreign threats in American politics. And you mentioned, I wouldn't want to end up 18 months from now saying we didn't do everything possible we could do. We would be remorseful if that happened. And by the same token, I don't want to overreact and 18 months from now or 5 years from now look back and say we overreacted, we acted prematurely without all of the facts, without considering all the constitutional implications for American citizens of what we did. For example, we rushed out and we undertook a rulemaking to diminish the First Amendment rights of American companies and their American shareholders or American labor unions and their American members because there might be some other foreign national shareholders or foreign national members of the labor unions. you know that this is highly precedented in American history. At times of concerns over national security, there's been an age-old debate of a conflict between American liberty versus American security. And you can look at the Alien and Sedition Acts, 1797, where there was an overreaction to concern about, in a time of war with France, about the influence of the Jacobins in American political thinking. There was an overreaction in the 1950s, where there was concern about Soviet influence in American associations and politics, and an overreaction with the Smith Act and subpoenas by the McCarthy committees. And so I just I think we just need to act soberly, deliberatively, and we have enforcement mechanisms to do that. And so I just want to be sure that we have that calmer times, you know, prevail in our thinking here. Now, as far as responding to specific proposals of what I think, you know, we can do, first, as I mentioned, I think our best mechanism for doing our fact-finding on these issues will be our enforcement procedures. And that's that they are well trod, and there are a lot of footprints on how to do that. You mentioned opening lines of communication. I agree, and I think we should have open lines of communication with sister agencies about these issues, especially where issues that may come before us overlap with issues that may come before other agencies.
Which ones are you thinking of when you say that?
Excuse me?
Which ones are you thinking of when you say that besides the DOJ?
Department of Justice is primarily the Treasury Department is possible. You mentioned FinCEN. Mm-hmm. This agency has mechanisms in place for communicating about common issues with the Department of Justice. We've done it with the IRS. So we have those mechanisms in place that preserve confidentiality of information while we proceed. I think also that this agency should offer up its expertise to our sister agencies.
Absolutely.
I mean, to the extent other agencies might address FECA issues, I think we ought to offer our general counsel's expertise to them to the extent that such advice is desired. You mentioned fact gathering and not recreating the wheel. That's on my list as well. It was on yours, so credit to you. But yes, we need to monitor. There are over a dozen other investigations going on, and some of those will render public reports about various issues, and they will have bearing and provide factual predicates for prospective legislative recommendations and rulemakings. So I think we ought to have a formal process here of collecting, monitoring, and collecting the reports and findings of other agencies, including congressional committees, and that those should be used to inform regulatory and legislative proposals. We've mentioned the FEC's IT security. It's not a secret. We've admitted it's been widely reported. Our agency's IT was hacked by a foreign source in 2013, and we have redoubled our efforts and spent money to improve and strengthen our IT security, and those efforts are still underway. And Mr. Palmer, you've done great work in that, and I think you'll acknowledge the Commission has given you the resources to do that. You mentioned making sure we have the resources in-house. I agree with you, and I think as we hire new attorneys, we may want to figure into the qualifications of new attorneys we hire gaps that we may have in knowledge of these issues, such as, you know, we might want to look for people who have worked in other fields. We have them, people who bring lots of, we have hired people from Department of Justice. We have hired people from congressional ethics offices, and those issues help us triage issues that come before us. And so I think that's a constructive suggestion that we should look at the the set of skills we have in our Office of General Counsel and whether they cover knowledge in financial money, you know, those types of issues, cyber warfare and computer crimes. We ought to look, make sure we have those skill sets inside our agency. I think it also always behooves us as an agency to ensure, you mentioned security clearances here. I don't know. That's something I'll have to consider. I just don't know practically what we would do. And as the chairman mentioned, whether all commissioners would have to get those security clearances as head of the agency that's going to be receiving, we ought to investigate what it would entail. If we're going to do that, though, I think we do need to redouble our commitment here to ensure that we aren't leaking, that we are a trusted agency, and that we aren't leaking documents and other things. And so I think we need to redouble our efforts to make sure that we have those types of understandings and commitments in place here as an agency. So I think all of those are that you mentioned. I believe there is a unanimity in those. And just in looking at things that are not in your memo, in just contemplating the complexity of this issue, okay, I think we need to be mindful of the degree of intersection with foreign nationals in our daily lives and politics. So if you look at news reports just from this last election cycle, these matters, as far as I know, are not before us, and nor am I making any accusations. I raise them just to illuminate the complexity that we face. But here's a Hill article where then-candidate Clinton said that she was having conversations with foreign leaders about obtaining their endorsements in the presidential election and would marshal those to show that she would be a better leader than Donald Trump. There are news articles where former Mexican President Vicente Fox said he had a meeting with Speaker Pelosi to encourage Mexican Americans to vote for the Democrats and not Republicans. And then if you look at Vicente Fox's Twitter feed, we were discussing tweets and Twitters just today. He tweeted out hundreds of messages, including there may have been some republications in favor of one party and against another from Mexico. And the list goes on. The French president endorsed one candidate, and it was published in a French publication that all Americans have access to. And so I think we have to consider all of the sensitivities that we face and the complexities of this issue as we undertake this issue. And again, Mr. Chairman, I believe that the enforcement mechanisms and procedures we have in place are the best path for us to take. Thank you.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Commissioner Goodman. You've spoken at great length. I think you spoke longer than I did. So there's a lot to respond to there. It sounds to me like what you are proposing is, well, we just should go along and do what we've been doing, follow our, as you call them, our tried and true enforcement mechanisms, wait for public reports to be issued, and what I am suggesting is that I think under the current circumstances we need to up our game and not just follow the tried and true. Frankly, there's been a lot of resistance in recent years to our having much communication with the Department of Justice, and it's been you know, almost on a phone call by phone call basis. Each phone call is required 4 votes to authorize. So that's not that if that's what you're contemplating, that is not what I am contemplating. I'm happy that you're willing to consider getting security clearances. I think that commissioners probably would need to get security clearances, and for the kind of briefings that I would suggest that we request, you know, I think. Yes, commissioners would need to get security clearances. I don't think that's an insurmountable obstacle, and I would suggest, you know, that we get a small number of staff people also. It's a few thousand dollars apiece. It's not in, it might take a few months, but I don't think, you know, there are apparently a bunch of lawyers in town who have security clearances based on the clients they represent. I don't think it's an insurmountable obstacle, and I think it would allow us to receive information that we otherwise would not be able to receive. And I think we ought to make affirmative outreach to, you know, if there are 12 ongoing investigations, then to all 12 of those investigatory bodies and see what they are willing to share with us. And I completely agree with you that we also should be as willing to share both any information that we have as well as our expertise here, which, you know, because there are money and politics issues that are being written about, you know, generally speaking, pretty much everything takes money to accomplish. So there may well be spending issues that haven't even shown up in the newspapers yet that if we started to dig in and try and get some more information, we would find out about. I also think that one of the alarming aspects of the just, you know, sort of what's come out so far is the ingenuity that's been and the aggressiveness that appears to have been deployed. And I think to say we should only focus on the things that have been identified in previously published reports and assume that no new tricks are going to be played, I think that's a mistake. I think to the extent that there are current loopholes that we either know about now or that we could identify through which foreign money could flow, then it would behoove us to try and address that, ideally before something lands in front of us in the enforcement context. I think we just need to make sure that we are closing off the spigots. I think I appreciate that your willingness to engage with me on the policy matters, on the prospective rulemaking matters. I don't think we need to resolve every aspect of that before we start a rulemaking and put it out for public comment. And I think that if we were to do that, we would get a lot of good feedback from a lot of smart lawyers and smart non-lawyers outside the building that would really enhance the product. And we should not predetermine that, you know, there's only one potential path forward and we're only willing to put out one set of options for public comment. I think that would be a mistake. So I guess
that's a question. If you haven't mind getting security clearances, it seems to me we need to take a look at exactly what we want to do with that. And how we're going to go about using any information or even successfully getting it, because any agency that I can think of that would have serious security issues before them is going to be very careful about how they give it to the Federal Election Commission, because they have no knowledge as to how well, we can, even somebody may have a security clearance here, how well our system is to protect that information, and they're going to want to know very carefully what we intend to do with it and why we want to get it, and so we'd have to ask them, I think, this is what we think we want to know more about. When you get down to the nitty-gritty of it, I don't think we can walk in and say we want to learn more, we want to get some security clearances and pick your brains, and so I think that's a problematic situation. So I'm wondering how are you perceiving that we might successfully get information that we don't need when 90% of the information that we I mean, I think there's areas where we really could learn a lot, and that is how money is moved. That's kind of my thinking right now, because there's so many different ways, and I've learned quite a bit about how bitcoins work, and it's incredible the way money can move, and people would not even know it. It's things of value. We it's not just money in the traditional sense. So those are things that I think might sharpen our rulemaking, and but I'm not too sure where you want to go with that. I think we should do baby steps. Remember the movie? Baby steps? You know.
If baby steps are the only steps we can agree on, then I'm willing to take baby steps.
I think we need to take it, you know, kind of focus ourselves and see where we want to go, and then I'll get an understanding that this is what we're going to try and accomplish. So, Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just can't help but think about the last matter that we had on the agenda, the volunteer mail exemption. We've been talking about it for 7 years. We're auditing six committees that have no idea what the legal standard is. Our own auditors and our own lawyers don't know what the legal standard is. And now we want to come along, get security clearances, and participate in investigations that we have absolutely no expertise in whatsoever. We know right now there are many other federal agencies and congressional committees investigating or doing fact-finding on the issues regarding foreign participation. The special counsel, the Department of Justice, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee, U.S. House of Representatives Intelligence Committee, and at least six other congressional committees are looking into various aspects of the 2016 election. So that's a lot of different entities. They're all part of the federal government. And we're now proposing that we get security clearance and go over to the FBI and ask them to let us know about confidential security issues that are going on in investigations with foreign nationals. And it's just stunning to me that that's something that people are actually considering doing. I think we should mind our own house. I think we should do the things that we're more expertise in. I agree that obviously if a complaint is filed, we have a specific statute in FICA called enforcement, and we should follow the statute and handle all enforcement matters within that context. And as you know, those matters have to be held confidential. Then, as far as all the other agencies that I just read, yes, we should wait until they've issued reports. We should learn from those reports. If they've found something that implicates our laws and our rules, then absolutely, we should open a rulemaking. And if it's necessary to curb some kind of in foreign involvement that we have jurisdiction over, yes, we should do a rulemaking then. But again, the notion that we would be duplicative, just now get security clearance and try to somehow wedge our way into ongoing investigations is really just, it's really hard to believe. I think that, as I said, we don't have the expertise to do this. And many other entities are already engaged in this, and they have been. These investigations have been going on for months and months. Newspaper reports just came out recently that President Obama knew about the foreign meddling as far back as August of last year. So now here we come almost a year later and say, we just got a security clearance, let us into your briefings. Again, we should do this professionally and responsibly and follow our statute, do this in the confidential enforcement process. Of course, if any other entity seeks our expertise on the finer points of FICA, of course we should provide that expertise. That I fully agree with. And we should offer any information that we get in our enforcement process to relevant departments. I think probably we're all talking about the Department of Justice, and we've done that before. But anything beyond that just seems to be duplicative and really not part of why we are here.
Well, on that, thanks, I agree. I think if we're doing baby steps, certainly whatever entity we're talking about, I think we would start with Department of Justice because we have a memorandum of understanding. We've had it for a long time. I think people forget, and in case people here don't know, we don't do anything in terms of enforcing law from a criminal perspective. It's all civil. It means that we can only fine. Nobody goes to jail based upon what we do. We operate on preponderance of the evidence. They operate on beyond a reasonable doubt. Everything is different here in that regard. So they have definite needs to have security that we don't generally have to have, and other than keep our processes confidential, which I think we do a pretty good job of, but I think we could maybe sharpen that up in some respects too. And maybe before we could talk to anybody about getting a security clearance, we ought to make sure that we can guarantee that we have that here, and I don't think we could probably qualify to do that right now. So I think if we want to do something along that line, that would be the natural place to start, and I think it would have to be a finite inquiry and see. And for example, if we refer a matter over to the Department of Justice, they may like to know that we've been through some process on an elementary scale to see if it's a case they even want to take. If we had more sophistication about that, that might help. Just those kind of things. But I think if we start getting on the telephone and calling up these other agencies and tell them we'd like to come on over and we want to get a security clearance so we can talk to you about your cases, I think it's going to be a hard sell. Thank you for the Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if people are misinterpreting me on purpose or I'm not being clear. Perhaps I'm not being clear. I'm trying to avoid duplication. I think we should reach out to other agencies that are involved in investigations. I don't know about you, but I've been reading about a lot of campaign finance issues. And I'm trying very hard to avoid talking about any individual. You know, my colleagues are, full of names and examples. All of them oddly seem to be Democrats, but okay. Those are all the examples that you can think of. I suggest that we reach out to the other entities in government that are conducting investigations and ask them whether there are campaign finance issues that are part of what they're looking into, offer to be helpful, offer our expertise, and ask whether there is anything that we should know about. They may have information, and they've got, dealing with us may not be their number one priority. They're involved in very sensitive investigations and trying to get to the bottom of things, and that's appropriate. Maybe it has not occurred to them that, maybe we have other folks in government that either should be in the loop or might have some expertise to share. So I would start there with just reaching out and saying, are there any campaign finance issues that you are looking at that you would like to either share information with us about or take advantage of our expertise in this area because we know a thing or two about that? I think that would be a constructive step. I would like to ask our staff to, I would like to invite our enforcement staff to make suggestions to us to tell us what fields of expertise they think they could benefit from adding to their portfolio. And I would specifically like to ask them to report to us and make a recommendation as to whether they think it would be beneficial to have at least a couple of lawyers on staff who have security clearances. And, I think it would have to be, based on the way we're organized, we'd probably need to have one or two in order to make it practical and useful, and I defer to our counsel on that, one or two staff attorneys, a team leader, and, probably the head of enforcement and the acting general counsel, because people are going to need to, as the chairman said, you need somebody else to talk to. There's no point in having one person in the building who has a security clearance.
But wouldn't that include the commissioners at that point? I mean, if we have to make any judgments, we would have to have the information that was, I'm just talking about where the proliferation would naturally go.
I think, it doesn't offend me that, commissioners and a handful of staff will all get security clearances. I don't personally see that as problematic, but I would ask that the staff make a recommendation to us as to if would it be useful, and if so, which staff or commissioners do they envision because obviously we're not going to get it for the entire Office of General Counsel or the entire agency, who do they think it would be useful to have that level of security clearance? And, you know, and there are different levels of security clearance, and what other skill sets would they find beneficial going forward? And I guess we're going to have to work across the aisle and see if there is any kind of a rulemaking proposal that we could even put out for comment. I would hope that there would be, but in the nature of how we do rulemakings, we tend to put out more than one option. So, you know, if the offer is put out our option or nothing, and only our option, that's probably not a terribly constructive path forward.
But would you reject it? I mean, if we're talking baby steps, I mean, that was my suggestion, but every time we add another layer of activity, it invites more disagreement where a smaller area of activity might win the day, and then it could go from there. And I know you look, give me that skeptical eye, but
well, it just
raising, you know, I'm raising the point. That
we have two proposals on the volunteer materials exemption, Mr. Chairman. We tend to have two proposals on everything. If you're saying, you know, why don't we just go ahead with what the Republicans want to do and not have a Democratic alternative or not have any alternative, then
I don't think anybody's saying that.
That's,
I think,
you know, a little bit hard for me to swallow.
I mean, there may be different points of view, but I don't think it's has to be partisan on things like this.
It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be partisan. You know, but that's what I'm trying to explore, you know, on this rulemaking idea. What I heard offered before was, you know, would you be interested in the proposal that the three Republican commissioners put forward before? And my response to that is I would be happy to put that forward as a out for comment along with other alternatives, or at least one other alternative.
Madam Vice Chair.
Commissioner Weintraub, going back to something that you said, I tried to write it down, but I think you said ask the other agencies if there are campaign finance issues that they are looking at and that they would like to ask us about. And I think that there was something else that I missed.
It's a two-way street, ideally, I would think. What I would like to ask other entities that are investigating this issue is, are you looking at any campaign finance issues?
Okay.
Are there issues where we might be helpful to you, where we could share our expertise? And are you encountering things in the information in the that affect campaign finance, that affect money in politics, that affect how money is moving, that you believe we should know about?
Let me just suggest this. First of all, and I think the point is well said, we are basically an enforcement agency and a disclosure agency. That's what we do. We're not in a position to, you know, move into voter law and those kinds of things. That's not what we do. We enforce the laws that we have on campaign finance. So we're talking money. And if you look at where we might go in the next few months, you'd be looking at the House, the Senate, the Special Counsel, the Department of Justice. All of those would be the natural ones to go to, but yet do you really think that given the nature of the situation that we could either add anything to their benefit or get much from them with the type of security that would be required, that, I mean, realistically would do us move the ball ahead for us in those areas? So if you say yes, I'd be surprised, but if you say no, then we'd have to go somewhere else. And to me, that's all, you know, sounds good, but I don't think as a practical matter we're going to have anybody over there in the House Intelligence Committee or the Senate or the Special Counsel or the Department of Justice wanting to really open up their dossiers and tell us about the issues they've confronted and here's how you can avoid this in the past when everything is on the move right now. I think if we were going to do any rulemaking that touches on some of these things, I'd be inclined to let a little time pass, because every month and every week we learn a lot more about how things have been moving in the system and with other countries, and those certainly can be educational just from watching what's happening. Just some thoughts. I'm not trying to put cold water on it, but I think realistically we have to take a look at what we can get done. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually think we totally should reach out to all of those entities and ask, and we will not know the answer to that question until we ask the question, because what I am reading in the newspaper suggests to me that there are campaign finance issues at issue that other entities are looking at. And I think we should affirmatively, and let me just finish the thought, because I'll forget it. I think that we have expertise to offer. I think that it may well be that informing us is not their number one priority, but if we ask, they may well say, you know, there are things that you should know about. And I want to stress that we have other functions besides enforcement and disclosure. We are the sole rulemaking body in campaign finance. We are the only entity that, under the law, can write any regulations affecting campaign finance or money in politics. So if there are issues that need to be addressed through rulemakings, we're the only ones who can do that.
Okay, I understand that, and I'm not saying that it wouldn't work. It just seems to me to be a hard sell, considering the
I take it I've got a hard sell here, Mr. Chairman.
I think I understand what you say, and I think we need to sharpen our tools in terms of how to deal with issues in terms of money moving in various directions. But I'm just not sure they're going to be feel confident that they can say, sure, this is how it works. And given the fact that there's some pretty tough issues that they're confronted with, and I don't think they'd want to make any mistakes unless they knew us really well and
they
knew exactly
no.
what we could do.
We won't know unless we ask.
just saying. Anybody?
Go ahead.
Madam Baxter.
So you're saying that because you've seen in the news that people might be looking at FICA, we should call up Bob Mueller and say, are you looking at FICA? Can we help you? And do you think you should let us know about it? And I think the odds of their sharing any information with us are not small, they're zero. And why I know that is because we've been interacting with the Department of Justice for years. Since I've been here, I can barely think of any information that they've given us on much more mundane matters than this. Much more mundane. They do not share information with us, and we all know it. And when you can look at all the close enforcement matters, you can see the lapse of time that we've waited in many cases to receive information from the Department of Justice that never comes on very mundane issues. So that's one. So I think it's very it's a certainty that they're not going to share information. And I have no interest in calling up Bob Mueller and asking him if he needs my help or if I should know about his investigation. I am not interested in asking him to let me know about his investigation. Also, there have been other times where we've read in the newspaper that the Department of Justice is looking into campaign finance violations. There was a couple of years ago, the hot button issue was coordination. And I remember being at several public conferences where the Department of Justice would say, we've got some new theories on coordination and we're going to enforce this law. And I don't recall anybody proposing calling them up in the middle of their investigation and saying, can we be helpful to you? And is there anything you want to tell us about your ongoing investigation? So there's no precedent for this. We have, as far since I've been here, we've never called up and done this type of thing. I also remember when John Edwards was, sorry, he's a Democrat, I just can't think of a Republican, right? If you think of one, let me know. But when John Edwards was being prosecuted for campaign finance violations, I remember thinking that the theory of the case that the Department of Justice was using was one that I didn't agree with. I thought they were misinterpreting campaign finance law, and I did want to call them and say, hey, you might want our expertise on this, but I didn't think it was my place to do so. I figured if they knew our phone number, and they're right across the street, and if they wanted to call me and get my read on FICA, they could have done it, and I would have been happy to give it to them, because I think he was wrongly prosecuted on a FECA violation that really shouldn't have been. So there's been numerous examples of this very kind of thing where we read in the paper about allegations and nobody has thought to get a security clearance or to ask for briefings or to find out if there's things that we should know about in those pending investigations, and I don't think we should start here.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I'll just comment that I think we should, in many instances, pay a lot more attention to what we read in the newspaper. And there are times when I think we should start investigations at our own behest based on what we read in the newspapers. And
there's a process for that. And if you get four votes, you can start your own investigation based on a newspaper report. You've got to get four votes, though.
Yeah, well, there are three votes who don't believe that we should ever do anything based on a newspaper report, so I don't think that's really going to lead us anywhere.
Well, I think we have to be realistic about that, and I think for us to, I mean, let me just ask you, suppose you want to investigate something and you find some wrongdoing, now what are you going to do? What will you do? We investigate, there's no respondent in sight, but we have somebody we're thinking about or an area, and we run across three or four or five people who are involved in what we perceive to be really bad stuff in terms of campaign finance. Now what do we do? Certainly, we've already made up our mind. I mean, are we going to go now and be the judge and the jury? How are we going to bring somebody to justice? Are we going to issue subpoenas? Would we then go over and give our, you know, reports to the DOJ and see what they want to do? And they, I mean, how much money would we want to spend on doing something like that? And with who on staff? So I think those kind of things would have to be thought out before we embark on something like that. So I want to hear what you have to say about if you wanted to move forward with an investigation without any defendant or pending case, what would your thinking be?
I don't even know. I'm not even sure what you're asking, Mr. Chairman, because I have not suggested that we engage in some free-form investigation with nobody in mind to investigate. I agree with you. I don't know how we would do that.
Well, suppose you did have somebody in mind and there wasn't any case pending before us. You say, well, I think that's a lot, you know, that's a violation, but what would you propose we do?
Well, there is, as Commissioner Hunter pointed out, there actually is a process in our directives for us to launch an investigation. And the fact that we, just like any other case, the fact that we launch an investigation doesn't mean that we have predetermined the outcome of that investigation. It just means there's something worth investigating. I guess I'm not seeing how anything I suggested would move us into...
You and I are the longest-serving people on the commission.
We are.
And you're just a little ahead of me. But we've never, to my knowledge, thought that that was something that we would either consider seriously or spend money for or budget for, that kind of thing. What's your thinking on that?
I disagree with you, Mr. Chairman. It has not happened.
I'm aware. I can take it.
I know you can. There is a process for us to launch an investigation if information comes to us. Certainly, you know, if another government agency were to provide us with information that caused us to think, wow, we should be looking into this aspect that maybe is not their primary focus, but they have come across some information that they decide to share with us. And the Justice Department has, you know, and other agencies have from time to time sent us information and said, you might want to look at this. So that's not unprecedented. We have a procedure for launching an investigation on our own behest. It hasn't been used very much because usually if it's in the newspaper, somebody files a complaint. You know, there have been times when I have seriously considered whether I wanted to deploy that, I think it's Directive 6, try and start our own investigation. But usually I find if I just, you know, wait a little bit longer, somebody else is reading the same newspaper articles that I am, and they file the complaint, and, you know, we deal with it through the normal complaint process. But I guess I'm not really clear on what I have said so far that would make you think that I am interested in launching some free-form investigation. Presumably, if we were to reach out to another government agency and say, is there anything we should know about that you have information on, and they said, well, actually, yes, we'd like to tell you about such and such, then we would have information. There would be, you know, it wouldn't be like we're just sort of roaming the streets looking for someone to investigate. We would have direction based on the information that was in front of us. I'm not really sure where all this is coming from.
Well, we have gotten in the past letters that suggest that we should they try and point out some wrongdoing and suggest that we conduct investigations. And I can think of some over the years, and we've never lifted a finger to do that. We've always waited, and I think rightfully so, in the sense that, first of all, we're not structured for that, but secondly, sooner or later, they seem to be at our doorstep anyhow, through some complaint that's filed. But if you can think of anything right now other than in the world that's before us in terms of things that are already under investigation, you know, we could talk about it, but I don't see where that might be. And I'm skeptical whether that is the best step for us to advance our skills. And I'm not convinced that we're leaving people free from potential law enforcement to any real degree because we haven't embarked on that. And I would welcome at our next meeting for some detail on how you would perceive we should structure our organization to go about something like that, because we have to figure out who's going to what legal areas we think might be violated, how much money it would take to investigate, what information could we get without a subpoena, what investigators that we have that would do this when we also have a lot of good serious pending cases before us. So, I mean, I think those are the technical issues that I would foresee we'd be confronted with if we were to take on an investigation like that.
I don't know what this investigation is that you think I'm proposing we take
on. Well, I don't either.
But you are
pointing out that we have the power to go ahead and do that, and so I'm just raising issues about what if we were to do that. How would you propose we, practically do that?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I don't know how to answer that because I'm not making that proposal. What I am suggesting is that we ask our staff to give us a recommendation about the skill set that any skill sets that are missing in-house that we would like to we think would benefit us to have. I am suggesting that we reach out to the other agencies that are investigating issues of foreign influence, offer our expertise, and ask them whether whether there's anything that we can do to help them, offer them any information that we may happen to have, and ask them if there's anything that in the field of campaign finance that they think that we ought to know about. I am going to continue to try and work with my colleague and see if there is any kind of regulatory proposal, because I think that there are current loopholes in the law that could allow, whether it is the thing that is in the newspaper today or not, I think there are people out there who are from foreign places that are trying to influence our elections, and if they have not found these loopholes yet, they will. And we really don't know, because there have been hundreds of millions of dollars in dark money that have been spent on our elections, and by the very nature of it being dark, we don't know where it comes from. And that's why my proposal about certifications would not get at what I would like to get at, which is to clear up where the dark money is actually coming from, but would merely find out where it's not coming from and make sure it's not coming from impermissible sources. And, you know, we would flesh out what that exactly what that means. I think that you, Mr. Chairman, have suggested to me that we could invite somebody from Treasury over here to further educate us on how some of these foreign money transactions are conducted, and I think that was a constructive suggestion that I wholeheartedly endorse. I think it would be a great idea. I mean, I think informing ourselves is the first step, but I don't want to wait until there is a public report out there 2 years from now. I think we should see if there is information that's available to us now.
Yeah. Well, I think things are more sophisticated now in the way money and things of value are moving, and how things of value are being increasingly looked at as something akin to a basis to enforce the law criminally. So I think we could sharpen our skills on that, and maybe the Office of General Counsel could give some thought to that. And I'm sure they would as soon as they hear what I have to say. No, Mr. Baker, the question was whether or not it might pay for the Office of General Counsel to take a look at some skills that we might want to sharpen up on. I'd use the keyword sharpen because we run across most of them anyhow. But from my interest, I'm interested to know how some of the money is being moved and things of value and how those should be kept in mind if we were to engage in some regulatory work, something like
sure,
that.
Sure, we could do that. Although I think we're not asking
for a security clearance. Security clearance.
But I think I need to state, since we are in a public session, there are no skill gaps in the General Counsel.
There we go.
Thank you.
You have that,
but
Mr.
perhaps
Doyle?
There are things that could make you even better.
We always strive to be better.
Very well said.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Goodman.
Yeah, I don't want to leave on a note of disharmony, because I think there was some agreement here today, and we should emphasize all about where we disagree when there is agreement that the issues raised in your memo are important. All of us are Americans first here, and so they're very important issues raised. You mentioned the skill sets for in-house. I think there's agreement on that. You mentioned starting some type of communication. I think where we might disagree is the understanding of how we might communicate with other agencies. I have my own notion of how it would be done, and it would be done through the normal procedures and processes of our, under the umbrella of our enforcement process. Now, you may have some other notion of how we're going to communicate with other agencies. I think the how-to can be resolved, but given that I take it that the issues to be communicated and shared and the expertise to be provided might be specific to individual cases. This is not just in the air. It would have to be done in an enforcement context using enforcement procedures. And then you mentioned rulemaking and looking for loopholes. Okay. You mentioned what your proposal would accomplish, and that is to at least ensure that the money isn't coming from prohibited sources. I think that our proposal does the same thing, because it requires someone, when making the expenditure or the contribution, to certify compliance with existing law that prohibits money to come from a foreign source to make it. The difference in our policy versus your policy is ours, the one that we have proposed twice and has been voted down twice, our certification proposal would call for or provide a certification mechanism for compliance with existing law, that only Americans make corporate political spending decisions and only American funds are spent. And we think that law is consistent with the definition of foreign principle in the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Your rulemaking proposal, and we think that could be done. That type of that would be a compliance mechanism that doesn't require rulemaking. Your proposal is a rulemaking that changes the law, that changes the definition of foreign national to go to some type of percentage base of ownership that I do not see in the organic statutes. So that is a something I'm happy to continue to discuss it with you, but that may be an impasse, and we need to recognize and get that elephant in the room up on the table, that we may you may be looking at what in the end result is a legislative recommendation and not just a jump out and do a rulemaking. And finally, you said if there are issues that need to be addressed, we should act on them in a policymaking mode. And again, I say, let's gather the facts. I think we're in agreement on that. This is what you said. Let's gather all the facts. Let's act thoughtfully, deliberatively. And my position is just the caveat that we not overreact. There is a frenzy going on in the news articles, in the news cycles these days. And I think that whatever policy proposals we make, whether they're rulemakings, whether they are policies, whether they are legislative recommendations, need to be informed by specific facts and findings. And based on what I read in the press, they are far more complicated given the ubiquitous information on the World Wide Web. And so before we charge out prematurely with policy proposals or overreact with policy proposals that aren't tailored to actual loopholes, I think it would behoove us to act cautiously. And that is informed by history. So I want to read Justice Hugo Black dissenting in Dennis v. United States 1951 decision, one of the communist cases, which tested the Smith Act. You know, I went to see the Scalia show at Arena Stage last night, who, of course, is quite a hero on the bench. But when it comes to First Amendment jurisprudence, there is no purer justice in the history of the Supreme Court than Justice Hugo Black, who said, "No law means no law." And so he was a great defender of those socialists and people who found themselves out of vogue in a time of fear and hysteria, fear of foreign influence in our politics. And so in his dissenting opinion in Dennis v. United States, he said, "There is hope, however, that in calmer times when present pressures, passions, and fears subside, this or some later court will restore the First Amendment liberties to the high preferred place where they belong in a free society." Mr. Chairman, I think that's the point you just made. We need to let some time pass and gather more information to act deliberatively before we rush out on this field too quickly in reaction to the news reports that we're reading. Former Justice Brennan, who was part of that Warren Court block, also throughout the 13-year period of the communist cases coming to the court, he later gave a speech looking back historically on that era in our history, and he said, "After each perceived security crisis ended, the United States has remorsefully realized that the abrogation of civil liberties was unnecessary, but it has proven unable to prevent itself from repeating the era when the next crisis came along." He said that in 1987, a lecture at the Law School of Hebrew University in Jerusalem. This is a common notion that in times of crisis we tend to overreact. And I'm throwing some caution to the wind that we act deliberatively and professionally in response to the issues raised in your memorandum. And I think there is a lot of agreement on the proposals you've made, and we shouldn't let some points of disagreement get in the way of that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Justice Brennan was probably talking about, you know, McCarthyism and the Red Scare and people losing their jobs, and you know, it's not what we're talking about here. But I do think that this is a situation in which people are justifiably concerned about what is happening, what has happened, and what could happen. I'm glad to hear the areas of agreement, but I'm a little bit frustrated because it sounds like, you know, there's a general consensus that, you know, we just, you know, shouldn't do anything too quickly. We should sit back and wait for other things to happen. And, you know, maybe in a couple of years we'll be in a position to assess what may or may not have happened. And I think the situation's a little bit more urgent than that. That's just my own personal view. I would like to get some clarification, though, because I've heard a couple of different approaches, so I'm really not sure whether there is agreement on this point or not. I mean, we've talked about different... It sounds like we would have to talk further about the mechanisms that we would use to seek the information, but I can't tell whether we do or do not have agreement that we should reach out to the other government entities that are conducting investigations in this area to see whether, again, I'm not looking to, you know, say, hey, just we're really curious and we'd like to know what you're looking at in, you know, the area of hacking, which we don't have a lot of expertise in. What I would propose that we ask is, do you have campaign finance issues that you're looking at? Can we be of use to you in that area? And is there any information in that area that you think we should know about? And what I have not been able to discern is whether there is or is not agreement to do that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Goodman.
Perhaps the reason that there is some vagary in that is because I think we're getting into the area of executive privilege on existing matters and the mechanisms we may use to address existing complaints.
I'm sorry. You didn't mean executive privileges in the executive branch.
I'm sorry. I meant our law enforcement confidentiality and privileges. Your point taken. And that's why I have been speaking around the issue that there are general mechanisms in place in the law enforcement context, and that's as specific as I want to be in this public meeting. Thank you.
Can we take it up in a closed session then?
I expect we will at some point.
My suggestion would be if we embark on that we consider, rather than a big plenary approach to a number of different agencies, we are tied correctly with the Department of Justice. And I think we should, if anything, begin with a conversation there. And they may say, you know, they could really use you over the Securities and Exchange Commission, or they could really use you over the, you know, they may have some ideas themselves. Certainly, I think they, you know, got kind of a black eye with Edwards, and they realize that. I'm guessing that if they talked and I thought it was on both parties, thought that their interpretation of the law wasn't likely to carry the day, that might be a good place to start. Hearing nothing. Does that mean that we've exhausted our expertise? Alec, what do you think on some of these issues in terms of, you know, we're talking IT, and could we benefit by, you know, calling other agencies and getting their IT expertise? I mean, I think given the money that we've spent and the people that we've hired and stuff, you might have some ideas on whether or not that's a useful step.
Mr. Chairman, at this point. I was hoping you're going to ask me if there's any additional matters.
Yeah, I know you. I know you were. I can see that. we'll make it quick.
Yeah, let me give that some thought. I think that's a very thought-provoking question, something that deserves some serious consideration. Allow me to think about that.
Sure, of course. Thanks. We'll do that. Any further comment? Anything from the Office of General Counsel? Commissioner Weintraub, this is your baby.
Well, it does seem to be my baby. It's not clear that anybody's interested in sharing custody on this.
Well, from my perspective, I think this was a very positive thing, and I don't think you can expect any of us, miracles on the beginning of some of these conversations, but I do think it's been good.
Well, I'm really glad we were able to resolve the Sergeant-at-Arms question. Right? I'm glad about that.
Well, with that, Okay, you get the magic question. Are there any matters no longer entitled to exemption?
Mr. Chairman, there are no such matters.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, that's not the question this matter. This management administrative matters.
How about that one?
Same answer.
Okay. Meeting's adjourned.